This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Regular gum is boring, but Icebreakers ice cubes are different. They're fancy. Icebreakers gum has flavor crystals, which deliver a rush of cool, refreshing flavor. Plus, they are delightfully cube-shaped, making them soft and satisfying to chew. Icebreakers ice cubes gum. Ooh, fancy. Pick up your favorite flavor today.
Dr. Chang? Dr. Chang, do you have a second, sir?
I suppose.
I just came in on the sub with the SWAN team. We actually met 3 years ago. I'm Daniel Faraday.
Yes. You arrived with Lafleur, I remember.
Right.
What can I do for you?
I need you to order the evacuation of every man, woman, and child on this island.
Now, why would I do that?
Because that man is on a stretcher as a consequence of the electromagnetic activity that your drilling unleashed down here.
Which is now contained.
It's contained down here. But in about 6 hours, the same thing is going to happen at the site for the SWAN station. Only the energy there is about 30,000 times more powerful, sir. And the accident, it's going to be catastrophic.
That is utterly absurd. What could possibly qualify you to make that kind of prediction?
I'm from the future.
Is over, but we have to go back down the hatch. It's the Lost Rewatch Podcast here on Post Show Recaps, talking season 5, episode 14, The Variable. Mike Bloom, oh no, I'm your son.
Asher?
It's me.
You?
It was me the whole time.
Oh, if only you had told me before I started bleeding out of my chest.
Oh, you knew. Oh my God. The Daniel Faraday farewell. It is here. Back in a flash and then gone just as fast. This is an episode I think we've been anticipating for a long time, Mike. And in the real time, if you listen to this episode, if you listen to Down the Hatch in the real time as we release it, I feel like the timing is so incredible. But the podcast drops on Fridays, so it's on August 13th, but we're just 2 days shy of that special date. 8:15. The day we launched Down the Hatch. So happy second birthday to Down the Hatch.
Yes, I'm going to curtly put a gift on the table like Eloise Hawking does in that curry restaurant in honor of our second anniversary.
How many
that
beats has the metronome on my GarageBand been going since we started recording Down the Hatch?
Yeah, at least like 8,150.
I mean, more than that. I think a lot more.
I have no idea. Yeah, each podcast is, with the exception of maybe a couple, or at least over 2 hours.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of beats going on. Maybe some of our mathematicians, RIP Daniel Faraday, could take care of that. But time really flies. You know, I remember when we were talking on 8:15 a year ago, we had that big brouhaha of, hey, let's, you know, pat ourselves on the backs and then some by listening to some kooky clips we did over the years. You know, I just moved into a new place. The world certainly still scary now, but I think, you know, it's certainly scary in a different regard. And to think about how much has passed and yet, like, how little it feels has passed. I mean, since we were talking then, what, we got through season four and we're almost at the end of season five. I'm trying to recall. Like, I'm pretty sure that came around the end of season three, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I think that that's right. But I think, like, we're not doing a clip show this year. We're just acknowledging it right now. A lot has happened and nothing has happened in some ways that it's like, I don't really want to revisit the last year, to be perfectly honest. But, like, it is just so wild that we are this deep in, right? That, you know, 2 years ago we started this journey and we're still going and we've got the whole rest of the year to go at the very least as we have season six on the near horizon. But I think, much like the survivors of 815 who are about to really be pressed for the rest of the show, we're hard at work, Mike. We can't miss a beat. We don't have time to stop down and do a bonus show. We've got a not a hydrogen bomb to detonate, but we got a podcast to make.
In 6 hours, this podcast will explode in your feeds. We've got to make it done. It's crunch time now.
Yeah, it's crazy. It is really, really wild to me that we are here, though. I know I've said it along the way of like the different like lost-ish projects that I have done along the way that have all just like stopped or just like, you know, like that just like didn't happen all the way that it was intended. And like, knock on wood. But here we are, like, really close to the end of season five, 2 years on from starting down the hatch. So I'm really excited about it. I'm in a really, really good mood as it pertains to Lost, even though the timing, like, tonal whiplash, right? Like, is it a little morose to be in a good mood right now, Mike, considering this very bleak episode of the show?
Absolutely not. I think there is inherent beauty and enjoyment that can come out of bleak things, or Damon Lindelof wouldn't have made The Leftovers. So I am super excited to talk about The Variable, and I'm super excited especially, I'll talk about this at the end as well, but shout out at the top too, because you deserve double the shout outs to the hatchlings out there, whether you are just joining us, if you're listening in the archives on a binge, or if you've been catching up on the week to week since this has started. It has been, to Josh's point, I think an incredibly fulfilling project for both of us. You know, I think both of us have done podcasts that have lasted years, but neither one of us had done a project where we've recorded every week, basically on the week for 2 years straight. You know, that's 100+ weeks of Lost content. It is wild to me, but it has given me somehow even more appreciation for this absolute gem of a show to be able to drill into it time and time again with minimal nosebleeds.
Yeah, we got to be careful with the drilling. It can really take you into some terrifying territory, all of the drilling.
We should also mention, so we're recording this in a bit of a time crunch, as Josh said, but I can only imagine just the bounty of Barracks Darmdarian fan art we have received in the past work in response to just this calamitous fan favorite character that was introduced on Down the Hatch last week.
I hope we do have a lot of Barrack Darmdarian fan art. I could see it going either way. I could see it going like, yeah, there's a lot of Barrack Darmdarian, or there's none. One way or the other would be my guess. But yeah, we're recording The Variable just a couple days after we recorded Some Like It Hoth. So as was the case with Some Like It Hoth, we do not have feedback prepared for you for this week of the podcast. So we're going to skip feedback this time out. We will get to the feedback next week, and we'll certainly resume it. We'll have it for the instant as well. And then, as always, we always have that season ender recap special where we go into the feedback. We'll talk about all of the things, all of the points, all of the stuff. We'll look back. We'll do all the feedback that we've missed along the way there. So definitely keep sending that in down the hatch at postshowrecaps.com. Mike, before we continue, I want to take a quick moment to shout out our sponsors for this episode of Post Show Recaps, our friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com.
Do you think Eloise Hawking took out a life insurance policy on her son knowing what would happen so she'd receive some sort of windfall of cash? Though I guess, would she? Are they allowed to accommodate for people who technically died like 30 years before their current frame of existence?
Probably not. I also don't know how you explain this to an insurance agent. There's a lot to like walk them through. I don't know. But Eloise Hawking, I don't want to put this past her either, because obviously there is very little she is not willing to do. The lengths she is willing to go. This is a very trippy episode of Lost. The variable that I think is, as I said last time, I think it's viewed as an elite episode of the show. It is a real statement piece of like the destiny idea, even if it's like in defiance of destiny in some ways, but in other ways, it's the fulfillment of destiny. And that idea is embodied in so many different characters. But I think for the character who is so centrally located in the ideas of time travel that come to dominate Lost in this era of the show throughout season five, for that central figure in that story, Daniel Faraday, to really represent in his death and his life whatever happened, I think is a masterstroke, even though it is so deeply, unbelievably awful. It's so bleak, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, not only because of the ending. There are certainly episodes, Hello 2 for the Road, that, you know, have a certain tone to it, and then there's just an absolute gut punch of an ending. The punch exists, certainly, but there are many, many blows thrown throughout. I think we got a glimpse of it in Confirmed Dead, but up to this point, Daniel Faraday has kind of been perceived as just, like, quirky, knowledgeable guy. You know, the expert on time travel. This episode truly paints a portrait of Daniel Faraday as an incredibly tragic character.
Yes.
Not just the way his life ends, but essentially how knowledge of that endpoint from a certain party has allowed his life to be so disastrous. You know, and it's disastrous in a different way than John Locke, who I think has had a grim fate befall him, but I think due to his own foibles, as it were. I don't think it's necessarily, well, you had to go to the island to do this, so therefore your dad had to steal your kidney. No, that was more so tragedy that was foisted upon by the circumstances. This is more so tragedy in, like, the Greek variety of, here is an outcome, and you have this ability to try to change your fate. You visited the Oracle at Delphi, said you're going to marry your mom and kill your dad. You said, hell no, but the universe makes it happen. In a way, it has a sense of course correcting, a path, if you will, to quote one of the many Eloise Hawking phrases. And to see that Daniel Faraday's life has been essentially full of suffering, that every time he thinks he's found a bright light, there is something dark and shady obscuring it, just shows that this man has earned so much sympathy. And importance as well, this is an incredibly important episode for the last part of season five. This is Daniel Faraday coming, giving Jack and Kate a mission, and then dying, and them sort of carrying on with it. Let me read a couple of interesting factoids I got from Lostpedia, Josh, about how this episode, we talked about how Some Like It Hot is the end of an era, but apparently the variable is the end of some conventions as well.
Yeah, we're killing conventions left and right. We're like Eloise Hawking, just shooting conventions out of the sky.
Or we're going to be like certain pandemics killing conventions. Coming back in a virtual capacity.
Not now, damn it.
According to Lostpedia, this is the last episode of the series to feature flashbacks interspersed with on-island action and focused on only a single character. So, again, this is something that has been ingrained in the DNA of the show since the very first episode, and this is the last time we're going to have a solo-centric episode with off-island flashbacks, because after this, Follow the Leader has no flashbacks, the incident is going to be, entirely centered on a bunch of people.
Abby Turno?
I mean, I'd say that's more so like a little bit off-island stuff, but mostly concentrated on the island. Like, this feels devoutly within that mold that Lost was created in.
Right.
And so I think this is the end in that regard. This is also apparently the last episode in the season and the series to feature events which take place off-island in present time, which is a big deal, right? Ever since we got the flash-forwards introduced at the end of season 3, 2007 has always been, or 2004 to 2007, has always been a different narrative. A narrative that has been present in the DNA of Lost for the past couple seasons. Now we're done with that. We're bidding farewell to 2007 off island after spending a good amount of time with it, specifically in season 5. So we're bidding adieu to a lot. And we're also welcoming in, as you mentioned, obviously a conceit that does not work in hindsight. Daniel Faraday is factually wrong, but I think there is a lot to say about not just what happens in these next few episodes, but like you said, the core conceit of free will and destiny, considering that next season we are going to get the introduction of a concept of some of you were brought here for a very specific purpose. And I think this is a really fun sci-fi way of setting up a conceit that becomes much more mythical and mystical next season.
Yeah, I also think I think that like there is something that is very like haunting and menacing about this episode and really toothsome about it. That like Daniel Faraday is, you know, we were so afraid of the freighters, right? Like we were we were afraid of like of what they represented, of what they would bring, the malevolence of Charles Widmore and how that would potentially level the playing field for our characters moving forward. And certainly many of them we were right to fear, Kimi and his posse and the and the havoc that they wreaked on the barracks specifically. But then there were these other characters who not only were not to be feared, but were to be trusted and indeed some of them to be loved. And I think that one of the most immediate breakouts, if not the most immediate breakout, is Daniel Faraday. I think, you know, Jeremy Davies comes in with this really quirky energy as like the time travel addled scientist who's like his brain is fried. He's got all of these strange ways that he talks like this, and he kind of looks at you like this. Something's going on, and he just has like this vibe about him. He's so singular. You haven't seen anybody like Daniel Faraday on the show when he shows up. And he's not dangerous. In fact, oftentimes he like kind of blows up the spot of the menace and the danger that his colleagues are trying to uphold. He's the person who, at least at the start of this season, in this very unsettling circumstance, Faraday is the guy who's trying to keep everybody together. He's trying to like lead the way through science. He knows what's going on. He's qualified to weigh in on this stuff. We should be listening to scientists as a society more often is something that the people who are left behind on the island certainly are saying, and ideally elsewhere as well. And then to have this guy like go through the trauma of losing someone who he had fallen in love with, whether or not like that story is something that you really care for. We litigated that fairly thoroughly back in the early going of season 5. But that's such a traumatic thing to happen to him anyway, to somebody who you're heartbroken for, because the show did a really good job of like making you connect with Daniel Faraday. Jeremy Davies as an actor did such an excellent job of making you connect with this guy and really feeling at a certain level with this guy, that then you take him off the board for a while, you bring him back in, he's got this huge heroic energy, still in that very specific way of just like absentmindedly waving a gun around and obviously drawing some attention as a result.
Never change Daniel Faraday. Never put a weapon in your hand. He's a self-proclaimed beginner for a reason.
You know, can I have something for beginners is such an underrated line that like he comes back and just when like you're getting back into the groove with him, and you're getting excited about what he's got going on, poof. He's gone in a horrible way, in this really, really cruel twist of the knife or of the bullet, as it were, where you find out that he's been here. He's been in our lives for this specific moment, that this was the thing that turned his entire life, was his death. His entire life is dominated by the way that he leaves this world. Is such a cruel, awful, horrible thing to have happen to a character that really, 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 really didn't deserve it. We've had the heroic death before. Like, Charlie Pace basically gets to go out on his own terms. Like, he owns his death. We've had the out of nowhere brutally tragic deaths, whether it's Two for the Road or Shannon getting shot or Mr. Echo getting ravaged, although he owns it to some degree as well. What happens to Faraday is so, so dark, is so, so troubling, and very much foreboding, considering that we are heading into a final season where anything can happen. At least in that first run, as like you're anticipating the final season. And not for nothing, the show will go on to kill a few characters that you really, really, really deeply love in awful, upsetting ways. And I think that this episode is not just like notable for its internal qualities of just like being like a really tight thriller. It's not just notable for it being a statement piece on time travel, but I think that Eloise Hawking basically fires off a warning shot and it lodges directly through Daniel Faraday's back and out his sternum. And I don't know where the bullet went, but maybe somebody else caught it.
I'm assuming it went into Richard Alpert and it just got absorbed because he just cannot die.
He just caught it. That it goes through, wherever it goes through and lodges into us. And it is this warning of like, we are in the end game now, Doctor Strange style, and Doctor Strange is dead. So good luck moving forward. I think it is a very important and notable episode.
It's Faraday being the Doctor Strange, like, this is the one situation where we can change things as he like silently holds up the finger. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting though, because I am looking at this episode and I'm looking at the life and death of Jeremy Bentham in the retrospect. Because again, I think certainly in the time we're watching John Locke be alive on the island and we're like, oh, okay, clearly he was resuscitated. But now we know he is dead, right? We know that both he and Faraday die in these incredibly dark, depressing ways. But I think it also shows how our messages and our brands can also outlive who we are as people. I completely co-sign everything you said with like what his death represents, the fact that he charges in ready to take the season by the reins and then just gets slaughtered is absolutely wild to me. Such a surprise and arguably like one of the biggest highs and lows of a character that we have ever seen on Lost. But I think to your point, what this and the Locke death in retrospect sort of represent to us is like there are cruel, unfair ways for these big characters to die. And while that is a part of that, there is a way for them to move on and to live on, which again, I think really fittingly sets up our secondary location in season 6, right? Another environment where these characters do live on and will eventually move on. It's really represented thematically here due to the fact that both Locke's edicts and Faraday's edicts are going to be followed by Jack Shepard, specifically. I think it's really interesting to map Jack's journey, which, as you talked about last week, he's been sitting there mopping up classrooms, just kind of waiting for something to happen because he believed Locke's premonition to come back to the island. Now he finally gets that in his lap. And despite what Faraday insists, I think Jack thinks this is destiny, and that's really going to push things forward for the rest of the series.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that this like this one feels like really, really notable because like there is no open-ended thing, right? Like this is an open and shut case. Daniel Faraday dies. We watch it happen. He does not spring back to life. At this point in the show, like we're still not entirely sure what's going on with the John Locke thing, but for the most part, people are kind of on board with John Locke is back. You know, like so we haven't really been able at this moment to like really kind of internalize that no, he got murdered in a horrible, hideous way. And that is like such an astonishingly brutal, terrible thing to happen to such an important character on this show, who was so lost and so confused, and was just like, you know, scrambling, clutching for purpose. And that's what he bought. Like, that's horrible. But you don't know that yet with Faraday. Like, you get that whole statement piece that like, sometimes this is how it goes in the single space of an episode. So this makes it like it's a really devastating hour to watch. I always struggle through the variable of just like kind of almost like Mike watching it between my fingers. It's like, oh, this is so harsh. This is so, so harsh. I think to your point, of course, though, that like this does like fuel so much of the character journey moving forward. That doesn't for me make it any less like of a stomach turner to sit through.
Well, not to mention the fact that everything is falling apart. Some Like It Hoth had some elements to it, but it sort of felt like the end of an era, the calm before the storm, in a manner of speaking, that yes, we do end things with the Phil stuff, but it felt like they had the Baby Ben stuff contained, like they were still trying to keep up the guys. Daniel Faraday comes in and quite literally blows everything up. He comes in basically giving this grand mission now that is going to now divide the survivors for the time being. This is a very significant episode in that it's going to make Jack V. Sawyer appear again for the first time in quite some time. As Juliet's going to muse here, it's going to blow up the cover they've spent 3 years building. Essentially, the peace that they had in Dharmaville is over. So it's such a game-changing episode. And we should also point out, Josh, I believe, technically speaking, this is the 100th episode of Lost.
Correct. Yeah. So, wow. 100th episode in time for our second birthday. You love it. We love this. This is great. Absolutely fantastic stuff.
And I also can't think of a better episode to be number 100, especially in season 5, because I think it really contains a lot of what makes Lost Lost, especially in its latter stages, right? Sci-fi concepts, themes of free will and destiny, big character choices, heartbreaking flashbacks. Like, this is actually a great microcosm of the show contained in an hour of television.
Who's Mike Rocosm? We will find out as we go forth into the jungle.
He was the guy that asked Faraday to put the hard hat on.
Yeah, I think that's right. Let's talk about The Variable, directed by Paul Edwards. It's a Kitsis and Horowitz joints. Their best episode.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have to go back. I think you say that about, I think you, Trisha Tanaka is, you love Trisha Tanaka. Mm-hmm. So
it's a runner at this point. it's Kitsis and Horowitz. Every episode is the best Kitsis and Horowitz episode.
Is it insert the moth meme here.
April 29th, 2009, Daniel Faraday dies. Let us get into this episode. It begins in 2007. It begins off the island as Desmond is being brought to the hospital. We're finally getting some answers as to what happened after he was shot by Benjamin Linus. It's all very frantic and sad and terrifying, and Penny and Charlie are both very, very, very concerned.
Yeah, so as much as I might be nothing burgered on the Desmond storyline in seasons 5 and 6, I really like the inclusion of the Desmond stuff in this episode. Because let's talk about the title, which is going to obviously key into an important scene later on. But The Variable seems like the spiritual sequel to The Constant, which was sort of mainly a Desmond Hume episode, but like almost a Desmond Hume and featuring Daniel Faraday episode, where Faraday plays a huge role in that, and as the last scene indicates, whether or not you mean in the literal perspective or more in the macro perspective, Desmond's presence is something incredibly important to Daniel Faraday. So I really like tying it into here, because that mirrors The Constant in a way of how these two guys are involved in each other's lives, but also really, really works in retrospect, because we're going to find out at the end of this episode, Josh, that Daniel Faraday and Desmond Hume are related. They are half-brothers-in-law, or however you want to take it. So it's almost like we are showcasing the Faraday family without even realizing it. And so I really like cutting to all this. It might seem a little weird to randomly have two scenes take place in 2007, but considering the previous links between Desmond and Faraday, and considering the blood links that we're soon going to find out about, I think it works 100%.
Yeah, The Variable. It's a family affair. Eloise Hawking is going to come to Penny asking some like innocuous questions about Charlie, and she says, "Oh, he has his father's hair.
Does he?
It's luscious, I guess. I don't
it's
know.
Luscious,
not
but
really.
It's blonde. Yeah, I'm a little. I mean, listen, my son's blonde, and I know that he has my hair, but I don't know. I feel like Sonia Wagar has pretty thick hair as well.
Yeah, I don't think it quite works. She says it's my fault that Desmond has been shot, and she goes, it was my son's fault. And Penny goes, your son is Benjamin Linus. And
she goes, oh, God, Hawking, good God, no.
And Ellie's talking, goes, no, 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 no. My son is Daniel Faraday, she says,
Daniel.
As she looks directly into the camera. My son is Daniel Faraday.
Daniel Faraday. I also love Eloise Hawking's like temporary indignation of like, oh, good God, no, I'm not talking about the genocidal murderer. Yeah. I'm talking about the man I shot to death 30 years ago.
My son is Daniel Faraday. So back in 1977, Daniel Faraday has returned to the island. He has popped out of the sub. We are picking up straight off of Some Like It Hoth as he looks over at Miles Lowe. Long time no see. And Miles is like, wow, it's been so long. I figured you were rich because you had invented the DVD.
Yeah, but no, Faraday was working hard in Ann Arbor, chilling up there near the Great Lakes when he said Great Scott, and basically, I don't know, I guess someone had either brought the recruitment photo or like they faxed it to him just to be in the loop, and he saw 815ers on there. And okay, so let's talk about this, because Faraday, it seems like what we're being told is that their arrival is going to completely spin off Faraday from his path, right? From the whatever happened of it all, to say, no, 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 we can change destiny, we can change fate. How do you feel about their arrival apparently being the game changer to like have Daniel deviate from everything he's been preaching up to this point?
I think, so here's where I'm at with Daniel Faraday. I think that he loses Charlotte in such a traumatic way. He's so upset, he leaves the island. He goes to Ann Arbor. He's probably spending all of this time thinking, is there anything I can do to fix this? Is there anything? What am I overlooking? What am I missing? He's just like lost and spiraling in his own grief. I think what he sees with knowing from like his notes and his notebook and everything, right, that the incident occurs on such and such date, there is probably like the big circled date on the calendar in his office for a very long time. It's this ticking time bomb of destiny. And when he sees that Jack and company have arrived, I imagine for him, that is like this thing that he has been like trying to avoid, this thing that he has been afraid of, this thing that he's been terrified about, or, you know, this looming deadline, not that the two things need to be mutually exclusive, is now something that he's like emboldened and ready to go after. And I think that for him, I imagine for Faraday, especially like it's, I think, kind of evident in the scene he has when he's talking to Charlotte, where he's like, I need you to leave in case what I try to do doesn't work. I think that for Faraday, there's probably some aspect of himself that is thinking like, either this is going to work and I am going to change the course of destiny, or I am assisting destiny in whatever happened. So I think that the arrival of these people is like the signal that it's like, it's time to like get out of the depression spiral and it's time to do something.
I think that's a really interesting perspective. To be frank, I wish we saw more of that. I guess, you know, I do feel like there's a part that's missing. I don't think we needed a full Daniel Faraday and Ann Arbor stuff. But while I do feel like it's incredible to see, again, the rise and fall of this character, I do wish we got some more filled in as to that malaise that you talk about. Because I think that completely maps. It just seems, upon first glance especially, that he's like, oh, because these three people arrived, he for some reason thinks that now whatever happened isn't real and he can move forward with his destiny. I really like your thoughts about how he essentially was looking for a sign. Again, to compare him to someone like John Locke, he was looking for a reason to go against conventional wisdom, because conventional wisdom for him is incredibly depressing, right? That like, okay, Charlotte had to die. There's nothing you can do. You're trapped in the tracks. And if he gets this sign in his head, it can spin this narrative of like, now, wait a minute, are they supposed to be here? Maybe not, so I can go forward with my plan. It's a little cockamamie, but that's the character. And I think given his emotional state at this time, I could understand why this is the spark for the powder keg.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense to me. Because like, if the thing is then that like there doesn't seem to be a lot of like hard science behind the like, I forgot about the variables. It's us. It's the people.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
like, no,
it's
but
the
that's
people.
But the people were already there. You were going around saying like, no, you're not a variable. You can't do anything. So.
Whatever happened. Like that was the thing. So I don't know. I feel like it's either like all of that or Faraday, who went off island and went to the 70s, just like did like copious amounts of drugs.
Who's not to say both, you know, especially what I don't know what the Hanzos were smoking up there in Michigan. But so Faraday is going to go like bang down Jack's door. And so, again, I want to keep asking questions about Faraday because this is his farewell episode. So this is when Jack sort of connects, you know, tells him, your mother told me to get on a plane. Faraday says, I got some bad news. You don't belong here at all. She was wrong. You don't belong here at all. Josh, do you interpret that to mean in 1977? Or do you interpret that to mean on the island in general?
On the island. You don't belong here. None of us do. We're not supposed to do this. This whole horrible turn of events is not supposed to go down. And we can fix it. We can change it. And I wonder if there is, like, you know, for Faraday's whole story to be sort of like this awful, terrible loop. Is there, like, this feeling of, like, as you're getting closer and closer to the end of the journey, do you smell it? Do you know? And so, like, he has, like, this idea of, like, we're not supposed to be here. This terrible thing, this horrible thing that we've all been driving towards, it has to end now. I think that that's on his mind in some capacity. Like, I think, like, this idea of, like, this place is death. You know, I think that those mm-hmm. words have probably played in Faraday's head on a loop for a very long time now. Sorry, Jack, you don't belong here. My mother was wrong. Let us check in on Daniel and his mother. The first of two Daniel and Eloise piano scenes in this episode. Let's listen in on little Daniel, sound number one.
What's wrong, Mom? Didn't you like it?
I loved it. It was beautiful, Daniel. Daniel, do you know what destiny means?
No.
Destiny means that if one has a special gift, then it must be nurtured. How many beats has that metronome counted since you started playing?
864.
Your gift, Daniel, is your mind. A mind that is meant for science, mathematics. And it's my job to keep you on your path. So, unfortunately, there's no more time for distractions.
I want to keep playing the piano. I can do both. I can make time.
If only you could.
Okay, this is completely random, but since we are getting into the first post-credits scene, can I bring up something that people might only remember from the very first time they watched this episode?
Yeah, of course.
So this aired in April 2009. In the very first airing of this episode, the Lost title sequence was a little different.
Ooh.
People might remember if they saw at the time. The Lost title sequence was placed amongst some stars, and there was a Starship Enterprise soaring through the O in Lost. People might remember this because I believe J.J. Abrams, of course, he of pilot Lost fame and nothing else. Lost is not a J.J. Abrams show, people. Please mm-hmm. get that conventional wisdom out of your head. But mm-hmm. he was coming out with his new Kelvinverse version of Star Trek.
Could you rephrase that real quick? You said coming out wrong.
Oh, sorry. Coming out next month, I believe, in May 2009. So to sort of like pay it back to someone who helped them all the way back in the beginning, they changed things briefly to have the Lost title feature Space and the Starship Enterprise. Again, it was taken away in subsequent viewings, and now on streaming it doesn't have that, but it's a nice relic for people who might remember it.
That's really funny. It would have been great if they had done a spaceship episode of Lost. I would have loved that.
Well, wasn't that the big theory that the island was a spaceship at one point in time?
This is probably the spaciest episode of Lost, you know?
I mean, it has the biggest space cadet on the show.
Little Daniel Faraday with his little braces
little brace face Faraday.
Yeah, tickling the keys, playing the piano.
I really love, we've talked before about the sort of like the symbolism of the piano with a character like Jack. I really like the recurrence throughout. Obviously, it's going to have a much bigger role in the Flash Sideways when Daniel Faraday finally gets to make time and live out his fantasy and be a rock and roll star playing alongside Driveshaft. But you see, when we between this and the next scene, we see his skills sort of denigrate, right? Like here, he does a great job, but I know I paid attention to the other scene at the piano. He can't play with both hands. And I can resonate with that as someone who played piano back in the day and now can no longer play with two hands, that like when you don't do it, you know, your mental aptitude to do multiple things at once sort of disappears from that perspective. I love the symbolism of the metronome. It's so small,
tick-tock.
But so perfect. Yeah,
tick-tock.
I mean, I love the fact that Daniel Faraday's character has always been driven by time. And the fact that in this particular instance, despite his insistence that he has had control over time, he still follows the metronome, right, as he keeps playing. And what Daniel Faraday is going to come to on the island is basically saying, like, we're going to break the metronome right now. And I think it's also a great symbol of his mother, I'm assuming, put the metronome in front of him because she represents the metronome. This is a really unique episode for Eloise Hawking, especially watching these flashbacks, knowing what she knows. And you can see it so much in the way she regards even little Faraday, right? She describes destiny as, if one has a special gift, then it must be nurtured, not you must do something. She's trying to come across more so like, okay, you have a special thing that you're supposed to do, and you must nurture it like it's an egg that's incubating. But the thing that really caught me was Eloise saying, it's my, insert pause here, job to keep you on your path. I think it's safe to say Eloise Hawking has instituted some emotional divorce in her relationship with her son.
Yes, that this is not, she's not parenting Daniel. She is like employing Daniel, that he has this very, 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 very important job to do. And if he does not do it, then not only does like space-time fall apart, but I think like the much bigger thing is, you know, we're going to like, I think we're going to really come to understand Eloise Hawking's motivation next time on Follow the Leader is really where it becomes clearer that like what she is hoping for is for Faraday to pull this off, is for Faraday to get this right, is for Faraday to, you know, even after his death, to detonate the hydrogen bomb through Jack, and therefore they don't land, and therefore he doesn't come to the freighter, and therefore all of this resets, all of this changes, all of this is different, and maybe, just maybe, it erases her horrible, horrible, horrible mistake. So I think it's actually compelling. It's really tempting to think that for Eloise Hawking, everything she's doing is specifically like sort of like TVA style to keep everything on track, to preserve the sacred timeline. When in reality, I think everything she's doing is to protect the sacred timeline up to a point so that Jack can fulfill the destiny, because she doesn't know what happens. Like, does it work? Does it work? Does blowing up the bomb work? Or is that the thing that just always happened? So I think that is a huge part of Eloise's story that is going to run as the undercurrent through all of this. But until that time, she herself not only has to keep keeping Faraday on track and you know, encouraging and developing Faraday's aptitude for science and his natural gifts and you know, pushing him into this place. That's her job. But her other job is to like not fall in love with this boy and hurt herself, you know?
Don't fall in love with the mark. It's weird to say, but like, yeah, she knows that this tragic thing has to happen. And again, we'll certainly chastise Eloise Hawking in certain ways, but I cannot imagine looking upon your, what looks like your 10-year-old son, knowing, okay, one of these days I have to kill this kid. You know, and not in like a baby Ben Linus way where it's almost the opposite with Saeed of like, you've done all these things to me as an adult, so let me try to kill you as a kid. With Eloise, it's more so, I know the end result, And the more I get attached to this, the more heartbreaking this is going to be.
Right.
There's an end, even if she hopes that end doesn't happen. And as she tells Daniel Faraday later, right, like every woman you come into contact with ends up devastated. And I think for Eloise, she's including herself in that because she's going to be devastated by what happens. And I think she's trying to protect herself a bit as well. Otherwise, it's going to be incredibly difficult to go through what she does. She even imparted this advice onto Desmond himself back in Flashes Before Your Eyes, right? He had to do this heart-rending thing of breaking up with Penny in order to preserve this. She's doing it here as well for the good of sending Daniel Faraday to the island.
Yeah. There's a lot going on. It's like, obviously, like, you watch this scene the first time and, like, you come to find out what Faraday's goals are here. And so, like, little Daniel saying, like, I can make time, I can do both. It's like, okay, cool. Maybe he can. Maybe that's where we're going. And then by the end of the episode, he dies. And so you go and you revisit this episode. And you're like, oh, no, that's absolutely horrible. Rewatching the scene and seeing the pained look on Eloise's face is like, oh, this is going to go viciously wrong.
And it's, again, it's why it's so tragic, is because Daniel Faraday has so much hopeful optimism over the course of this episode. We can change it. It's going to work. And this was voiced. There's a little bit of like an adolescence in there, a bit of a childish naivete that we see was in him as a child, was repressed by his mother, who again forced him within these boundaries for a very specific reason. And now that he feels he has broken out of those boundaries, he can be like, no, I'm like a kid again. I'm a kid in a candy store. Yeah, I can play the piano. I can do this too. We can do anything. And he can't. It's just so brutal.
Yeah, it's horrible. So Faraday, back on the island, he's got an errand to run after he says this to Jack. I'll be right back. Famous last words. This is a horror movie, by the way. Jack is going to go to Sawyer and fill him in because this is, again, this is just more and more like, I got to report up the food chain. Let me tell Sawyer. Right. Faraday is back.
This is interesting. So Sawyer, you know, loads up a gun. Clearly, they have Phil in the closet. Jack says it's 6 a.m. This is interesting to me because as DTH listeners might remember, Pierre Chang on this day woke up crisply at 8:15. So the timing on this is a little sus, but I guess, you know, timey-wimeyness of the island, maybe they don't remember necessarily the because you left timing of it all. Just an interesting thing to point out.
Yeah, he also, yeah, that's a good point. The timey-wimeyness is absolutely fair. Does it take like 4 hours to get to the Orchid? Probably not, especially because then he's going to have to go back to, yeah, the timey-wimeyness you kind of have to forgive or get completely hung up on it. I don't think there's really much like talking it through. Yeah.
Is Pierre Cheng's clock 2 hours, 15 minutes late maybe, and he just hasn't bothered fixing it maybe because of the electromagnetic wonkiness?
He's adjusted to it. Sawyer is going to, at Juliet's behest, bring Jack in to the circle of trust with Phil, Jack, Phil. Really fun stuff with stupid freaking Phil locked in the closet. At the Orchid station, Faraday comes to speak with Pierre Chang, and we see that first scene from the entire season basically play out all over again as he comes down with the hard hat on, and Daniel Faraday speaks with the most important character in season 5 of Lost. Let's listen in. Sound 2.
Did you hear that? Time travel. How stupid does that guy think we are?
Yeah,
it's my episode. It's the last time you're going to get the chance to hear from me for a very long time, if maybe ever. Unless Mike and Josh remember to bring me along for the way. And why wouldn't they? I'm a very important guy. I'm Saul the Drillman. If it wasn't for me, none of this catastrophe would have even happened. You wouldn't have gotten this show you like so much. So you should actually really be thanking me at the end of the day.
I feel like that's fair, Saul.
In the scene by the creek, there's actually Saul Goodman just sort of like taking a leak in the background being like, oh, don't do that. Then this show doesn't exist. And then I can't be a character in season 5. I don't want to do that at all. So maybe there's like a hidden...
Daniel, while you're down here, could you actually go back and change time so that I could be on Bracking Bid? That show that everyone's talking about, Fracking Bad. Like, I want to be on it. I want you to have me there. Then you do Better Call Saul and it's with me.
I want to star with the guy who Miles spoke to about 20 years from when this actually takes place.
I saw that episode. That's the Dean Norris. I wanted to, he was the dean of my school. I want to get back to that. I want you to put me in.
Yeah, Dean Norris.
I actually don't know what any of you are talking about.
He's related to the pilot of the original plane, Seth Norris, who's going to crash this plane, unless it doesn't, if you want to change things. But now you see, if you don't do this, Breaking Bad doesn't get made, and
it
especially
doesn't,
Better Call Saul the Drillman.
I want to be part of that, for this fracking fad. High and bye to Saul the Drillman. We saw him so long ago in Season 5, and now we see him again here. I love this little guy.
I love this guy, and I love, to that point, though, what I really love about this episode is how much full circle comes around in this episode in so many different ways. And here we have it where it ties back to the very first scene from the premiere. And again, we still have a lot to go in this season. But I like the fact that we were dropped in the middle, right, of the 70s. Daniel Faraday's there. We're wondering what the hell is going on. And now we have truly come full circle from that perspective, just seeing how far we've come. There are several other full circle moments throughout this episode, but this was the first one I really picked up on.
Yeah, I really, really like it.
Regular gum is boring, but Icebreakers ice cubes are different. They're fancy. Icebreakers gum has flavor crystals, which deliver a rush of cool, refreshing flavor. Plus, they are delightfully cube-shaped, making them soft and satisfying to chew. Icebreakers ice cubes gum. Ooh, fancy. Pick up your favorite flavor today.
This episode is brought to you by Captain Morgan Sliced. Since the dawn of bread, people have known the truth. Sliced is better. That's why new Captain Morgan Sliced went all in on four bold, deliciously sliced cocktail-style flavors. Pineapple Daiquiri, Strawberry Margarita, Mango Mai Tai, and Passion Fruit Hurricane. Visit CaptainMorgan.com to find Sliced near you. Does not contain real fruit or juice. Captain Morgan & Co., Plainfield, Illinois. Please drink responsibly. 21 plus only.
With over 2,300 hotels across the U.S. and Canada, Best Western is perfect for our annual spring hiking trip. It feels a little like
okay, back to the hotel. What a great day.
Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western.
So this actually does, of course, lead us to the other side of the scene that we've been waiting on for so long. We listened to it at the top of the show. Faraday comes to Pierre Chang, explains to him all the things that are going to happen. We've got 6 hours until the Swan unleashes an electromagnetic wave that is 30,000 times more powerful than what has happened down here. It's going to be a catastrophic accident. And the reason he knows this is because he is from the future. Bum, bum, bum. And on the surface, as they leave the Orchid Station, Miles is helpless but to watch as Daniel Faraday doxes him. Let's listen in. Sound three.
Dr. Chang, wait. Wait 1 second, please.
Yes.
Wait.
Yes. You're from the future. You heard me talking about time travel. Now you've had your fun. Good
no,
for
no.
you.
Please, Dr. Chang. Just look at my journal, please. Look at these equations. Some of them won't be discovered for another 20 years.
Hey,
Dr. Chang.
Hey, Dan,
please.
Leave the man alone.
Sorry, Dr. Chang. I think he had too many drugs on this side.
Dr. Chang,
Miles is your son.
Excuse me.
Think about it. A Chinese man named Miles, the same name as your baby, shows up with me from the future. You really think this is all coincidence?
Is this true?
No.
Please, stay away from me.
Dr. Chang. Dr. Chang!
Hey,
are you out of your mind? What are you doing?
I'm just making sure that your father does what he's supposed to do.
And what's that?
You'll see.
What I will say, again, this is TV, so of course it doesn't happen, but a little bit of a boo on Daniel Faraday for taking so long to reveal the Grand Master plan in this episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he's just stretching it out, and like he's on his own planet, so it's in character, I think, that he always keeps pretty tight counsel. And like, I mean, even if you think about earlier in the season, like he's just like kind of moving at a pace that no one else is really like, what do you got going on? What's the plan, Dan? Like, what are we doing here? What is all of this? And he's like, you know, it's too complicated to explain, I think. So like, I'm not gonna, he's always got this sort of vibe to him. You know,
but yeah. So we talked about this. Faraday is going to be the one to really throw the grenade in the sort of LaFleur guise that has been put up over 3 years, which he was a part of for a good portion of time. And I think it shows to the point that you made before. I do think Daniel Faraday feels this is an all or nothing mission. Like, obviously, he's going to be incredibly surprised that he dies at the hands of his own mother. But I think it's within the realm of possibility that he comes back to the island thinking, okay, either this works and, you know, I defy destiny, or it doesn't, and I probably die along the way. But at this point, it's worth it. And so I do think him just going like completely for broke, breaking the rules of time travel by revealing he's a time traveler, though he did do that back in Jughead as well. Him essentially saying like, this all doesn't matter. It's what's ahead that matters, really shows his mission and just his penchant to push forward no matter what's going on.
Yeah. And I think like just like Miles having to confront the Pierre Chang of it all is a really good beat in this episode.
Yeah, because then, you know, Miles is, I mean, they're going to get to Chang eventually, but in this moment, Faraday is going to face his first amount of pushback from Miles, right, who, as we talked about in Some Like It Hoth, for various reasons, does not want to deal with this issue, and so he just completely denies it. Chang's going to write Faraday off. We'll put a pin in that until next episode.
Yeah, I mean, he's not really writing him off, right, because he's like, it's a Faraday seed. You know, it's going to start to linger. It's going to linger. In flashback, we see it's graduation day from Oxford, as Eloise has showed up to take Daniel out to lunch. And Daniel, with his long, luscious locks, another wig watch, Mike.
Yes, the mullet is back. I can't remember if it's the same mullet from The Constant, but it's similar at least.
He's got it. It's luscious. It's flowing. And he wants to go out to lunch with Teresa and his mother. And his mother is like, definitely not with Teresa.
Yeah, well, I think it's because she saw her matriculating before and saw she fell both down the stairs and up the stairs, and she has nothing for that physical goofery, Teresa.
At lunch, Daniel is so upset. Like, you were so rude, Mom. Why are you always so rude to everybody? And she says, don't waste your gift on a woman. The women in your life are only going to be terribly hurt. Speaking from experience, says Eloise Hawking.
Yeah, so we really get, I think, probably the biggest introspection into their relationship. And specifically, I think Jeremy Davies does a really great job in these flashback scenes of just showing turmoil. And it's not turmoil in the way that we'll see later on of like, my memory is broken up islands, I'm not sure if I'm here or there thing. Here, he is legitimately, you know, upset. He feels like, as he said, his mother keeps pushing him. When will it be enough? Again, I think very sympathetic to those of us that have been watching 5 seasons of Jack Shepard and what he's experienced with his father as well. Obviously, much different circumstances, but I think that you could see that though Eloise has her reasons behind why she's really putting him at arm's length and making sure he does the things he's supposed to do, we see the emotional turmoil it is wreaking on Daniel Faraday, right? He can't live, essentially. He can't carry on with anybody. He has to focus on his work only and to satisfy his parents. When will it be enough? I mean, it is, but it'll never be enough, Daniel Faraday. And that's the saddest answer of it all.
It's really, 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 really brutally sad. He's going to reveal that he's got this grant from Charles Widmore. Who's the grant from? His name is Widmore.
Some industrialist.
Charles Widmore, he
looks
says.
Directly in the camera.
Yeah, he looks up from his meal and just looks directly at the camera. Charles Widmore. Eloise doesn't want to fight after that because like it is just another reminder of how much closer he is getting to this predestined point. She came to give him a journal and her congratulations in the journal. Daniel, no matter what, remember, I will always be your mother. Your mother who shot you.
I will always shoot you. I mean, love you.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, this is a little bit of that causal loop. This is Eloise's version of the compass that Locke gives to Richard at the beginning of season 5, right?
Yes.
She's going to next episode read her own inscription within the journal and now realizes this is a great microcosm of how she is continuing this path right now. Like, she has to make sure I have to write in this notebook and give this journal to Faraday so that he'll use that journal on the island to travel back in time so that he interacts with everyone, shows those equations. I may or may not shoot him. The bomb may or may not get set off and change everything. So it's a big piece of thing. It's, you know, a brief story of how Daniel Faraday got his famed journal. But I think the fact that it comes from his mother says everything about how Daniel Faraday's fate has been tied to her in so many ways.
This whole, in every way, right? Like, in every way that his life has always been. And this is, you know, like, the Jack Shepherd stuff is going to be, like, kind of bearing this out next season as well. Of, like, his life has been driving to this the entire time. Mm-hmm. But, like, in a much more, like, literal, loopy way, we're gonna come to find all of that out. So the fact that the journal comes from the woman who gave birth to him and also gave death to him is not lost on me.
I gave death to you. I love using that term now. If someone kills someone, no, I've just given death to you.
I've given you death. They've given you death. Death. The gift of death. All right, let's go back to the island and let's saddle up with our friends here in Dharmaville who the party is ending and they need to come up with a plan, and then Daniel Faraday is going to walk in with a plan of his own. Sound number 4.
All right, people. Party's over. I know y'all just showed up. The rest of us have been here for the past 3 years. This is our home. Last thing I want to do is leave. But we ain't got no choice.
Let you in the closet. I thought he worked for you. Can you convince him that it was all like a misunderstanding?
I punched the man in the damn face, Hugo. What am I supposed to say? My fist slipped.
How much time do we have before someone realizes he's gone?
Not enough.
So where do we go?
We only got 2 options. We can either commandeer the sub, get the hell off this island before anyone knows we're gone, or we can head back in the jungle, start from square one.
I'm not getting on that sub if there's a chance that my wife is still on this island.
Yeah, me neither. After all we did to get back here, and now we're just gonna run off again? Seems kind of wishy-washy.
Right. It's 2 votes for square one. Anybody else wanna...
Hold your horses. Be right there.
Hey, James.
Welcome to the meeting, Twitchy. Good to see you again. Pancakes in the kitchen. Help yourself to the punch.
He's still crazy.
It's on a whole new level, man.
Great.
Jack... I'm sorry if I was rude before. But what I came to do is of critical importance to everyone in this room. Does anyone know where I can find the hostels?
Why do you need to know that, Daniel?
Because one of them is my mother. And she is the only person on this island who can get us back to where we belong.
You ready to hear something wild?
Yeah, of course.
This is the first and last time Daniel Faraday and Hugo Hurley Reyes ever interact in the series.
So crazy.
The two of them have not met each other before this meeting.
That's so wild. That feels wrong, and yet I know that's right. Like, then you think about it for like another 5 seconds, and it's like, yeah, because Hurley was in Dharmaville the entire time, right, of season four.
Then he was with Locke and Ben. And then Faraday was at the beach in the Zodiac boat while Hurley was in the jungle, and then got on the chopper.
Yeah, they
comes
never
to the
had
island
a chance.
While Faraday's been away. This is the first time they've ever interacted with each other.
That's insane. I wish that they had more. That's such a bummer. But it is what it is. You know, that we're at this stage in Lost where they just like don't have time. I can make time.
Well, you thought you could. I just love how Sawyer AC Slater's it on the chair, by the way. Like, that won't be patented for another 10 years, chronologically speaking. But I love that he decides to do it to really get down to business as to the two options they have in this moment.
Yeah, J.F. Sawyer. He's giving them the spiel, you know? I would have loved to have seen the rest of the meeting play out, because I feel like he wouldn't have done it the same exact way as Horace, of like, I want it to be unanimous. He wanted to hear what everyone has to say, I feel like, with Sawyer. So that's really great. I love his leadership style with Jimmy Ford. I also love when he says, like, yeah, help yourself to the punch.
Yeah, punch and pie. I think it's pound cake and punch, actually.
I think it's pound cake and punch. So Faraday getting a sip of the punch as he is telling us what his plan is to punch back against destiny, or at least one part of the plan. We got to go and find Mom.
Do you think Sawyer was like, pound cake and punch, and then he just punches Daniel in the face?
Yeah, that'd be
great.
Just
so punch happy after all this. Like, he's something released with Phil. He's like, wait a minute, I can punch my way out of things.
I haven't punched anyone in a while. Yeah, it's been too long. I think it may have started with Saeed, with like punching him in the face with his face.
Yeah, and I think at that point, Sawyer's like, oh my god, there's a rage that's been unlocked in him.
I've been bottling this up for so long.
And I agree that I think seeing more of the ensemble here could have been a fun moment, because again, I think Jin and Hurley are not going to be having that much more time this season, but it was interesting to hear both of their responses to the whole, okay, take the sub or square one in the jungle, right? Jin says, much like Sun does, no, if there's any chance of finding Sun, why would I leave the island? And Hurley says it feels wishy-washy to leave after they just came. You can't leave with who you came with.
That's
in
right.
That regard.
We know
and,
this.
And also, maybe there's something in Hurley that's telling him, like, no, you should hang out on the island for a little bit. I think good things will happen to you when you hang out on the island much longer. Don't leave.
Yeah, he's meant to be here. You know, it would be wishy-washy to just go. All right, so we'll see more of what Faraday has got planned in a little while. First, let's do a flashback, and let's get the other side of Daniel Faraday crying about the Oceanic 815 crash.
Such shocking news, Josh, that his hair grows instantly between shots.
Instantly. Very, very funny. I know that there's been some continuity stuff along the way, especially in season 5, that we probably haven't stopped down and examined quite as much.
I forgot to mention this last week /2 days ago for us, that I don't believe Miles somehow grows a goatee and mustache in like the 2 minutes between whatever happened, and Some Like It Hoff.
This kind of thing happens on television. What are you going to do? But it is notable here, especially in this scene, the hair length difference for Faraday. But Charles Widmore is going to show up.
So this is really fun callback. I didn't notice this until this viewing. So there is a comic book that is sitting on Daniel's couch as he's sort of just like watching everything happen with 815. It is the same comic book, Josh, that Richard Alpert has when he goes to visit young John Locke in Cabin Fever. And I love that so much. First, because we know that I think that's March has 32 days, right? We talked about that in Whatever Happened, this idea of if you knew you were going to die, could you change your fate? Really ties into Daniel Faraday. But I think there's a lot of similar DNA here, right? In someone who knows Daniel, or like knows what's going to happen to him, assumingly, coming to visit him, almost not on his orders, but like, again, sticking to this preordained path, providing him with this opportunity. There'll be an initial deviation from it. I guess that also begs the question, because I don't believe we see young Widmore in his, you know, young stage or middle stage ever directly interact with Faraday, But do we think Widmore knows about Daniel Faraday?
Yeah, I do. I think that you get the sense of that from the conversation he has with Eloise at the end of the episode, right?
Yeah, I would imagine so as well. Because, like, again, even though he wasn't around for it, especially if him and Eloise were knocking boots for quite some time, and imagine that she told him about it. She's obviously probably still, I think, in cahoots with him during the 70s, that she's probably going to relay this information to him. And so we talk a lot about the Eloise side of things. The Widmore side of things is incredibly interesting as well. You know, Daniel's never exactly going to have a conversation with his father knowing he's his father, but to see what Widmore does as well, the tactic he takes in trying to push Daniel on his path, I think is another really interesting dynamic.
Yeah, do you have any thoughts about Widmore as a father to Daniel? Certainly we've got a big body of work as far as Widmore as a father to Penelope Widmore.
It's a little bit, it reminds me a bit of, again, going back to Christian Shepherd, because I guess he is sort of like the hallmark father in a bad way. King Daddy Kwan's a hallmark in a good way, but it reminds me a bit of Par Avion. Right when he drops by to visit Carol Littleton and is just like, hey, Claire, let me help you out. And in that one, I think obviously it's much more evident why he's there. But I think it's a similar dynamic, right, of here is someone who kind of wants to be in this person's life. For Widmore, I think it's more so that he feels he has to be. If he has to be the one to bring Widmore to the Faraday to the island, and like this is what he has to do. I think it's one reason why he's been absent in his life up to this point. As opposed to Christian Shepherd, where it was more so like, this big thing happened, let me appear in my daughter's life and give her advice. I think Widmore, much like Eloise, is going through the motions of playing his role. So again, he's not really playing the role of father here. I think more so Eloise and Widmore are not parents here, they're advisors.
Yeah.
They're sitting down with Faraday being like, I think you should do this. This is the path that you're meant to take. They're guidance counselors. And so it's almost tough to regard them as parents in that regard because they're not outright saying they are.
Yeah. He's telling Daniel that, what if I told you these people aren't dead? The plane was fake. It was a hoax. I put it there. And Faraday's like, why would you tell me that? And it's like, well, that's a very good question, Daniel. I don't know why I told you that. I probably shouldn't have.
Well, here's the thing. Well, Winmore says, you know, you probably remember or did the next day. I wonder, does this, you know, come from it when they met Daniel Faraday back in the day? If it's like, well, he didn't say anything about me planting the plane, so therefore I assume he had no information about it. But man, if only Faraday did, him and Frank would have had some absolutely lovely conversations, right? Because Frank would be like, it's all right. I was right the entire time. This is incredible. But yeah, I mean, speaking of Faraday, I think Jeremy Davies does a really great job here as well, playing addled Faraday, I think is a good way to put it, where he's having trouble completing sentences. This is clearly much, much after the experiments he did on himself and Teresa have just left him, like, completely shell-shocked. He's not full Minkowski, necessarily, but, like, clearly his mind is separated in so many different places. And I think he does a good job with it. It does make me wonder if we were missing a type of scene in season four, not exactly on the level of, like, John Locke feeling his toes for the first time in Walkabout necessarily, but this idea of Faraday, you know, realizing how much the island is healing him. Right. I think that's our assumption, right? Is that like he has this disconnected memory and the island was healing him in a manner of speaking. Do you think we're missing that in the midst of Faraday just like getting back to action with everything going on with the constant?
I think, you know, there is like, if you need to place that for yourself, you could have like that I'm Daniel Faraday, I'm here to rescue you moment, kind of could be like, you know, like sort of like he's back, you know, like I've got myself again. Like I think like there could be like some interpretation of that. I would have loved that. I think that it's a good call that I think something like that would have been really, really, really nice to have on the show. I think about the, like, you know, this condition that's affecting his memories, and like, is he like Minkowski tripping? Is that something that's going on for him right now? And I wonder, Mike, if there is this like period of time for Daniel Faraday that we as viewers never get, but like some of like the emotionality surrounding him. Does he see all across his life? Is there a portion of Daniel Faraday like during this time that like sees what's coming, that knows, that gets some of that stuff, and then coming to the island, he like loses that like foresight? But does he have some of that foresight right now that's like coming and resetting, like Memento style, Guy Pearce style?
I completely think so, and it's for one reason, and whatever length of hair it is, it's him crying at the 815 crash.
Right, exactly.
I think it's him, it's deja vu for him, but in this case, it's that, okay, it's not that I have to link up with these people in the future, I think it's more so, I'm linking up with 815 people in the past, and it leads to my death, right? Like, I think it is an echo of some sort of memory there from the past or from the future that is going back to him, you know. Again, it's addled, so he doesn't necessarily remember it completely, but it's this sort of, like, feeling. You know, I have a feeling that my heart is linked to 815 and that, you know, my fate is linked to the crash of Oceanic 815, and he can't put his finger on it, especially from Daniel Faraday's perspective. But I do think there is something to his mind sensing something to do with Oceanic 815, whether it be him flashing forward to his time, you know, in 2004, or flashing forward slash back to the 70s and knowing how he's going to be in the mix with these people.
Yeah. I think that there's something there. I think there's something there. He does ask, he says to Widmore, "You sound like my mother." He says, "Yeah, we're old friends."
wink, wink.
He's like, "Why are you winking at me?
Is this the pop secret song plays a la Arrested Development?"
I'm not winking at you. Why are you winking at me? Okay, it's because we had sex. Back in 1977, Faraday's got this plan. Sawyer's want nothing to do with it, but Jack is in. He's in. He's like, "All right, I want to get involved in this. I want to be a part of whatever you got going on."
I find it interesting that Sawyer points out, like, no, you know, like, you're going against whatever happened. I don't know. To me, this goes a bit against what Sawyer does with the Ben stuff, right? Where he sort of says, screw whatever happened. Like, I have to move forward and do this. Again, I think Sawyer had his reasonings behind it. But I just think it's interesting logic here where he's like, oh, I thought you said this, when he himself sort of exercised that idea of, well, maybe this thing did happen and we're a part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. I think, like, I don't know if the show loses the plot on Sawyer by the end of the season, but, like, I do think, like, you know, he's a little shaken up right now. He's not quite as in control.
He has a man in his closet right now.
Yeah, that's a hard thing to do. Everybody, though, is, like, going against Sawyer. So, like, Jack is going to go with Faraday. He convinces Kate to come along to take them to the hostels, and he brings up Aaron, which he said he would never do.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is a really interesting... really interesting scene for the Sawyer dynamic, right? Because this entire time since they've gotten there, even with the LaFleur stuff, it was always turn to Sawyer. Sawyer will know what to do. He is losing control here, right? Faraday has come in and basically said, no, I have this big, shiny new thing. And everyone's turning here. You know, Kate is going to be the one to be like, oh, no, we should do this. You know, but Jack does, even though he's really hitting a sore subject by bringing up Aaron, I think he is right that, you know, oh, the reason... I don't know the reason you came back, but I can assume it was not in 1977.
It's not here.
And Kate's like, I mean, yeah, unless Claire happened to time travel with us, which we'll get to in you know, season six. But yeah, that's probably the case. And even Juliet is on Team Jack, right? She just turns to Sawyer and says, it's over for us here anyway. She is, I mean, Juliet is someone who I think is able to divorce her emotions easily. She certainly has her heartbreak, but she's someone that knows how to, like, swallow that bitter pill and then get knocked out on the sub for a few hours. So I think it makes sense that she's given this harsh dose of reality of what they need to do, that the bubble has burst, and she's like, all right, move it on.
Moving along. So she's on board, too, by giving the code. Miles gives the keys. He's not getting involved any more than he already is. And by passing the keys, that is Miles' goodbye to Daniel Faraday.
Yeah.
Sawyer tells everyone, pack your stuff. Meet back here in 20 minutes. We're going back to the beach.
And we should also mention that I believe this is where Sawyer has those words with Jack, right? Where he says, when you realize the huge mistake you made, we'll be back at the beach right where we started.
Yeah.
That's an incredibly packed line, in my opinion.
Yeah.
More packed than they're going to be in a few minutes, because that is, I think, Sawyer saying, you know, right where we started is from a physical sense, right? Basically being like, this is a fruitless mission, and we're just going to go back to the beach and start over from square one. But I kind of feel like this is Sawyer, like, declaring to Jack, like, well, it was nice working with you for the time being, in a manner of speaking. We could only hold this for so long, you and me working together, but I guess, you know, we're always not going to see eye to eye in this case. I just find it interesting.
I think Sawyer's looking at Jack right now. He's like, God, I can't stop thinking about punching you in the face. I'm really gonna have to do that by the end of the day today. So that will happen.
Because let's remember, Sawyer had that talk with Jack where he's like, just sit put, let me do the handling. I think from Sawyer's perspective, he feels like Jack is defying him, that like he couldn't follow his orders and he is now, stepping past his boundaries. I mean, I think what Sawyer isn't necessarily seeing is that it is all falling apart around him. And so he is losing control without Jack. But I think it's an interesting step forward and step backward in honor of Daniel Faraday to this dynamic that they've really, specifically like the rivalry they really had brewing in seasons 1 and 2 before Locke stepped into the picture.
100%. So Jack and Kate and Faraday are going to head to the motor pool, but Faraday gets sidetracked because there is a kid on a swing set nearby that he needs to have some words with. Here it is, the haunting sound number 5.
Not allowed to have chocolate before dinner.
It's okay, sweetheart. I won't tell.
My name's Charlotte. What's yours?
I'm Daniel. I'm new here. Listen. Do you know Dr. Chang?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Hopefully, really soon, Dr. Chang is going to ask a bunch of people to get on the submarine and leave the island. When he does, you and your mommy, you're going to have to leave. In case what I do doesn't work, you cannot be here. You have to leave. I tried to avoid telling you this. I didn't think I could change things. But maybe I can.
Another circle complete, Josh.
Yes. Oh, God. It's so rough. I'm not allowed to have chocolate before dinner has never been more upsetting, even though that first time it was pretty upsetting. But like now getting like this other piece of it is, oh,
but it's also an indicator that clearly I imagine Charlotte was like triggered by seeing Daniel's face. Right. And like that's what prompted that flashback. But yeah, I mean, this is also, though, I think should have been a warning sign to Faraday in the moment of, oh, crap. Yeah, whatever happened. I've been actively avoiding trying to tell Charlotte to leave the island because she told me I would do it. I end up doing it. But again, I think he's so focused on his mission that he doesn't notice that, oh yeah, we still can cause things to happen in the flow of time. As much as I actively try to avoid making this event occur, it still occurred.
It's still occurring. It would be the kind of thing that, like, I feel like if he wasn't still, like, so grief-addled and time-addled and like, deadline-pressurized, that maybe it's like, oh, this is probably a tell that what I'm going to try and do isn't going to work. But I almost feel like for Faraday, it's like, well, what does it matter if it doesn't work? What's the worst that could happen? Like, I may as well be dead anyway. You know, I feel empty inside. So I think, like, especially like probably seeing Charlotte here is just going to increase his resolve to at least try. Even if it's like a fruitless endeavor, he's going to at least give it a go.
Right, and I think that also, you know, you wonder why is Faraday just so incredibly upset talking with Charlotte. I think for me it's a memory jogger more so than anything. Yeah. I think it's him just realizing, like, the heartbreak he experienced losing Charlotte, which, again, we should mention, didn't work so much for the audience, but apparently really, really traumatic moment for Daniel Faraday. And I could imagine as someone who probably had this person on his mind, I could imagine there's a difference between, like, having her in your head and then seeing her in person. Probably drudges up a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And so I can imagine that, like, there's a lot loaded in Daniel Faraday's emotional chamber in that scene as he's about to load up his own gun in the motor pool.
So he goes to the motor pool, and he gets a gun from Kate, who gives him like this huge rifle, and he's like, "Do you have something for a beginner?" which I love.
We should also mention, though, this is another full circle moment that I just realized this time around. When Daniel Faraday first landed on the island, remember, it was him, Jack, and Kate.
Yep.
And now it's them again. I think that's a really fun moment that the way Daniel Faraday arrives on the island and leaves the island involves the exact same two people.
I think it's no coincidence that the entirety of the Daniel Faraday story is so circular. Time is a flat circle, as another show will say. So he ends up getting a handgun. This one's ready to go, she tells him. When Rosinski and his posse come rolling up and Faraday just like steps out, he's like, "Oh, yeah, hey, what's going on, you guys?" Like, he waves at them with his gun.
He's got a gun! Yeah, nobody cares what he's saying because he's waving around a gun. When, again, like, guns are often found on Dharma premises. It's why they have some in the motor pool of all places. But you don't actively wave them around. And Rodzinski was just coming over to find Faraday because evidently it seems like this sub of scientists, I know that Faraday came on for different reasons, but I guess they were all sort of recruited to help work on the Swan, which unfortunately means they were all part of the incident and might not have made it out. But, you know, essentially Faraday's missing from that. And as soon as a gun comes out, the firefight starts. And Faraday is going to shed the first of what ends up being a lot of blood here when a bullet grazes him in the neck.
Yeah, he gets, like, shot in the neck. Jack is always a wild man with a gun, I feel like. We talked about this before, where he just, like, shoots so intensely. I don't know if there's, like, a not intense way to shoot a gun, but, like, there is, like, something that feels very charged about when Jack just, like, goes in. Like, he's just been waiting for an excuse to go off. And he shoots, this is total like action movie stuff, right? Like big bada boom, that nearly consumes, Rosinski and everybody. They're able to drive off and just barely escape in like this torchy action sequence.
Right. They shoot, I think the van that they show up in, right? It blows up, and then they grab a van, Kate crashes it into the Dharma van, and then they're able to drive off with like some spare shots being thrown at them. So yeah. If it hasn't become abundantly clear at this point that the reverie of Dharmaville is now broken, it's as shattered as the windshield on the Jeep right now. Like, there is firefight within the confines, Dharma-on-Dharma violence. It's going down.
A little triggering, literally, to see all this violence in the barracks again, Mike.
That's very true.
I hate Rosinski, too, so much, so I love seeing him get the losing end of this firefight. Ugh.
Yeah, it's very much out of the action movie, right? Of like the stormtrooper-esque firing. They got away! Despite the fact that they had three guns trained on them and one of them was shot in the neck.
Yes. But they still lose. All right, let's do one more flashback. Much like Faraday's entire time on the island has this full circle quality, right? We get a full circle quality to the flashback portion of this episode that began with a piano playing Daniel Faraday, and his mother having a conversation. And so let us return to those exact circumstances. Sound number 6.
Hello, Daniel.
Mother. When did you get here?
Oh, I just arrived. I would have called you, but...
I would have forgot anyway.
I hear you have been offered a job.
How do you know that?
Well, it's my business to know. I came here, Daniel, to tell you that it is very important that you say yes to Mr. Widmore. That you accept this opportunity.
I can't. He needs someone who can do really, really complex space-time calibrations and calculate bearings, and I don't want to do that anymore.
Daniel, this place he mentioned to you, this island, did he tell you that it could make you better? What if it's true? Why, then you could go on with your work. Just think of all you could accomplish.
You really want me to go?
Yes.
Will it make you proud of me?
Yes, Daniel, it will.
And I'll do it.
Oh, it's so sad.
Nail meet coffin. Hammer meet nail meet coffin.
Drill meet nail.
Jill meet Saul. Saul meet everybody. Everybody meet me. I'm Saul. I'm Drill Man. It's me. It's Saul.
No, he's not here.
Yeah, I mean, this is...
It's awful.
It's awful. And you could tell, like, again, she knows the end goal. Daniel Faraday has to go to that island. And she has to say whatever she needs to say. And I think from that perspective, he's so pitiful in this scene as well. Like, Faraday, I think, had indignation in their last scene together. Here is he's just broken, right? He's you know, even the way he talks about, oh, I probably wouldn't remember if you told me that you were coming ahead of time. It's just so sad.
Brutal.
And shows, again, much like John Locke, how coming to the island obviously is not going to end up in good things for him. But also, like, it does... It changes his life forever because it does allow him to be happy again, if only for a brief portion of time, or at least feel whole again. But the real gut punch is when he says, you know, would that make you proud of me? Mm-hmm. And Eloise knows, like, yeah, I guess I'm going to have to, like, emotionally hook this guy into signing his own death warrant. And there's also the pregnant pause that she takes as well when he asks, you really want me to go? Before she says yes, like, you could tell in that moment, there's probably a last minute decision of, I could say no. I could say no and see what happens, but I know I can't. If he doesn't go to the island, none of this happens. I have to say yes, no matter how much I may regret it.
We are drawn to certain choices, you know? You get to a moment and you think that you were going to say no and you say yes, or the other way around. Like, I think one of the reasons this show is so resonant and this episode especially is so haunting is I feel like many people, perhaps even most people, know that feeling of, like, I should zig. I'm going to zag.
Yep.
I'm zagging. Oh, God, I'm zagging. You know, like,
why did I zag?
Oh my God, I can't believe I zagged. I should have zigged, but I zagged, and this is where I live now. I think that is very evocative of things that we do as human beings. And so I think that moment is played really, 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 really beautifully well in the writing and the acting in this scene, this final scene, between Eloise Hawking and her son. This is the last time she's ever going to see him.
That's what's implied, right? That, like, this is the last meeting, and then Faraday signs up to get on the freighter. I think it's really interesting to have this scene after Daniel talks to little Charlotte. I think there's a lot of similarities with this idea of someone like Eloise and someone like adult Faraday feeling like there is something I have to push that I don't want to push, but I know needs to happen. And it's going to be heart-rending, but I need it to happen. And I think there's again, like mother, like son in that regard. I think he ends up doing in 1977 what she's going to do probably like 27 years later or what have you to her very son. So again, it's not only about going full circle. I would also say there's this idea of like ripples in a pond as well, which Faraday is going to suggest coming up here in a little bit. And I think the echoes that we see in the way Eloise is treating this idea of a path versus what Faraday treats of a path is both dichotomous, but also synonymous.
Yeah. Jack is going to be patching up Daniel Faraday. And I love that this comes so close to the end of the episode.
Yeah, like, right? Because it's a scare, right? Of like, oh, well, he got shot in the neck, but he's fine. So he's bulletproof in that regard.
So it's like, wow, that was close. And I think like in that way, like kind of like mirroring some of the feelings around, at least I've talked about this a little bit, of like what it felt like with Charlie back in season one, that they go so close to killing him that they'll never do it. They'll never do it now. Like they could have done it right there. They'll never be able to top it. And then hold my Dharma beer. Give us a couple seasons and we'll do it. So they do the same thing here. Like we could have shot Faraday to death in this moment. Nah, we didn't do that. So he'll be fine. Literally 5 minutes later. You know.
But it doesn't help here, right? That Jack says, "Well, I thought you said whatever happened happened." And Faraday says, basically explains what Miles tried to explain to Hurley and whatever happened happened. Like, no, we're still on our timeline. We can get hurt and we can die. So again, even though he has survived this bullet wound, he is going to say, no, we could still die, like I might 5 minutes from now.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's out there, like on the tip of the tongue of the show. You know, it's like, I may die at the end of the episode.
Yeah. And we get a lot of, I think, point of no return talk in this episode, which again is interesting considering that we still have a few episodes left of season five, but you really get this just repeating of this phrase over and over again of like, you know, show's over, our job is done, there's no turning back, of okay, we are moving on from this. And so even though we're still going to be living with these characters, I think to your point, this episode serves as like a statement from the show of how we are transitioning over the course of a few episodes into something completely new, or at least newer for Lost for its final season.
Yeah. All right. So Sawyer and Juliet back at the house. They're really going through it, Mike, here at the on their final day in paradise and Juliet's final day anywhere.
It's wild to think about. Like, again, Faraday pointed out this, the next episode and the finale take place over the course of 6 hours. Which is wild to think about, though, again, timey-wimey-ness. But yeah, there's a little bit of trouble in paradise here, right? Like, Sawyer is, I think he's a little unnerved about what happened. He admits that Juliet ended up being right about how things will never be the same since 815 got back. And even the still got my back, still got mine, there's some tension there, in my
big
opinion.
Time.
I guess that's the read, right? It's like, the way they talk to each other, it's not as even... they weren't loving to each other when they talked about it in Jughead, but like it feels like there was some support there. Here is sort of like, I love you, like when you just say it to your partner, but you don't really mean it. You say it just because you have to say it. That's what this feels like here. This feels like James and Juliet's I love you said a bit dispassionately in the moment.
Yeah. It's gotten intense. It's gotten intense. I think it's like a little bit of back to business, you know, honeymoon's over. So a little bit, you know, metaphorical in that regard.
I love that. So Hurley and Jin are walking. They've got everything packed. They see Radzinski pulling up. I think Jin speaks to Korean for the first time since we've seen him in 1977, which I think is a very fun small detail, right? That like, again, he's put up the guise of being able to speak English. And the moment the jig is up, he defaults back to Korean.
Yeah, they're not going to get involved in this. Here comes Radzinski and his posse again. We've been infiltrated.
Yeah, he is bellowing. Like, he is furious that, okay, the new recruits have helped Faraday. And then just when LaFleur tries to, like, put out another fire, the first fire comes raging back, and then they hear banging from the closet, the jig is up.
The jig is up. So that's a thing, as they pull a gun on Sawyer, like he's really busted now. So that sucks. That sucks for our guys. Meanwhile, back out in the jungle, Daniel Faraday at the creek, you know, the one, good to see you, old friend.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to saddle up next to the creek And Faraday is going to lay out the stakes because Jack's like, all right, just tell me what you're planning. I've taken you this far. Just take me the rest of the way. And Faraday's like, it's probably a good idea just in case I die in 5 minutes that somebody knows what I'm about to do. So let's listen in on the plan. Sound number 7.
In about 4 hours, the Dharma folks at the Swan Works site, they're going to drill into the ground and accidentally tap into a massive pocket of energy. The result of the release of this energy would be catastrophic. So, in order to contain it, they're going to have to cement the entire area in, like Chernobyl. And this containment, the place they built over it, I believe you called it the hatch. The Swan Hatch? Because of this one accident, these people are going to spend the next 20 years keeping that energy at bay by pressing a button. A button that your friend Desmond will one day fail to push. And that will cause your plane, Oceanic 815, to crash on this island. And because your plane crashed, a freighter will be sent to this island, a freighter I was on and Charlotte was on and so forth. This entire chain of events, it's going to start happening this afternoon. But we can change that. I've studied relativistic physics my entire life. One thing emerged over and over. Can't change the past. Can't do it. Whatever happened, happened, right? But then, finally realized. I've been spending so much time focused on the constants, I forgot about the variables. Do you know what the variables in these equations are, Jack?
No.
Us. We're the variables. People. We think, we reason, we make choices, we have free will. We can change our destiny. I think I can negate that energy.
Under this wand.
I think I can destroy it. If I can, then that hatch will never be built, and your plane, the plane will land, just like it's supposed to, in Los Angeles.
And just how exactly do you plan on destroying this energy?
I'm going to detonate a hydrogen bomb.
Just like that, we have our mission for the next 2 episodes.
It's so cool. It's such a good scene. And I think, the science of it is indefensible. It's like, what show are we watching? Like, all of this is totally
ridiculous.
Yeah, there's
a polar bear on a freaking island. So yeah. There's a, I wouldn't say like deleted scene, but extended scene of this this particular scene, Josh, which is really, really interesting. First off, that scene in the extended version is done in a different order. The mention of the variables comes before Daniel lists the series of events. Hmm. And we actually miss out on another Faraday metaphor, nothing about records or songs. He tosses a small stone into the creek, you know, the creek, and says, the creek keeps washing over any pebble thrown into it. A pebble represents a change, a small change. The creek is time. And then we sort of like fast forward a bit. We talk about the variables. And then, you know, he says, if we can't change the past, can't do anything about it, then we don't even bother trying. But if we decide, if we believe that we can change the past, then we don't use pebbles, Jack. And he picks up a big rock. We use boulders. And he throws the rock in the creek. See, if you drop a big enough rock into a creek, you create a dam, right? And then that creek changes. And then he goes into the entire, like, and then this happens, this happens, this happens. Jack says, when you said you could get us back to where we belonged, you weren't talking about where we left from, were you? Daniel says, no, because none of us belonged here in the first place. I think I can negate that energy. I think I can destroy it. If I can, then the hatch will never be built, and your plane will land just like it's supposed to. None of this happens, and that freighter will never be sent, and finally will be free. And I'm kind of sad we don't get this version, Josh, because I feel like there's a lot of really interesting vocabulary from Faraday here.
Well, I think that that version of events is less like television, you know, like I think it's less like, you know, dramatized for the sake of a commercial break, which this very much is what we get on the show. And so it works as like a thrill ride. And so I still love it. What I feel like you're describing is like the kind of thing, like the way that it's originally cut. Like, I feel like that's the kind of way that you see it maybe now, or maybe even back then, but like not on ABC. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, I feel like you're really allowing the viewer to live in the character's existential dread, because I think that the way it's depicted in this sequence of events you're describing feels to me a lot less like a plan and a lot more like despair. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm. I feel like it is like, it is really, if maybe despair is the wrong word to like lean on as the punctuating of that idea. I think it could be more that it's like, it's very existential.
Well, no, I completely agree. And I think that's what I think I'm missing most from this version of the series. And by the way, I should mention that from the commercial break aspect, the Finally We'll Be Free does get followed up with, and then just how do you plan on destroying this energy? I'm going to detonate a hydrogen bomb. So it still has that like bomb aspect to it. But I think I agree. What's in this version of the scene is desperation.
Yes.
Specifically Faraday's line that Freighter will never be sent and Finally We'll Be Free.
Right.
Like that specific last four words, I think is so interesting. That Faraday is doing this all because he feels like shackled, you know, and he feels like this is the last ditch effort to free everyone. In this scene, though, it's more so emphasizing that last ditch more than effort, right? He has this plan, but to your point, the way that Faraday is phrasing it himself, it's more so like, yeah, we did these little rocks, but maybe if we do a big rock, something will change. We all need to do something that will finally be free. And I just find it so intriguing because, again, Faraday's talking about how destiny is poppycock. You know, that you were told one thing, but actually you're not meant to do anything. But he's using so much destiny-driven language here. You know, finally we'll be free. Specifically when he says none of us belonged here in the first place, that sounds so destiny-driven in my opinion. That, like, there is a time, a place, and a purpose for everyone. That I find it interesting that he is sort of co-opting that language to his own mindset of, okay, maybe there is a path, but I can change it. And maybe the reason why my life has been terrible so far is because I've been in the wrong creek at this point. I haven't redirected the stream to a happier path for all of us. Like you said, the scene is absolutely incredible without this stuff. But just reading it back, I found it really interesting how they re-edited it. And in particular, how there are a couple things that Faraday says that don't make the final edit, which I think, to your point, recolor a bit about sort of his state as he's going into his final hours here.
Yeah, I think they want it to feel heroic. I think they want you to go into this last act feeling the optimism of Faraday and also feeling like the danger and the intrigue. That I think at this moment that the vibe of, oh my God, what is this mad scientist thing? Like, I think they want to sink you in like the provocative ideas that Faraday is tossing out. I think that's what they want to be the predominant feeling right now.
Yeah.
So that when he does get killed, it's going to be like a real swerve. And like that now is like very dangerous as well.
Well, I mean, this is major in so many ways. This is by far the biggest stakes we have ever seen in the history of the show. You know, getting off the island is small bananas compared to we are going to change the past so that we never landed on the island and the show never existed in the first place. That is a wild end goal.
That's not just like a commercial break. Like that's the end of an episode. It feels like, you know, like that is like such a, I mean, like it will be like the cliffhanger of season five for sure. Like, did it work? You know? But like it is like, oh, is that what this whole show is about? Making it so that none of it happened.
Right. It's changing the fundamental DNA of the show. This is what everything we've experienced from day dot has the possibility of just being completely erased. so that they start over anew. They are absolutely wild circumstances. And I got to say, when I was watching season five, Josh, like, again, like I said, there was some stuff in the middle here where I was sort of like, okay, this is fine. This reinvigorated the hell out of me. Oh my God, are they actually going to do this? I think it's a grandiose plan that, of course, doesn't end up happening because it's a wild idea and whatever happened. But even the proposition of it understandably has these characters working overtime in the next two episodes. And it's a game changing proposition for everything we know about the show up to this point.
All right, let's go back to 2007. We're going to resume some of the talks between Penny and Eloise and finding out about Daniel Faraday and things like that. And Eloise is going to apologize. I'm sorry about what's happened to your husband. He's become a casualty in a conflict that is much bigger than him or any of us. And for the first time in a long time, I don't know what's going to happen next.
So let's talk about this. You brought up the Loki comparison, Josh. Big She Who Remains energy from Eloise Hawking here, right? We've crossed the threshold.
Yeah, and you know what I think is compelling to me? We never really know where she goes with all of this, right? Because we never really check back, other than this scene and this final scene that she's going to have with Charles Widmore here. We never come back to Eloise in the present. We come back to this version of Eloise in the sideways, and I think that there are things to glean from that, and I think that that will be a fun conversation to have. Like, what kind of context clues do we get from what her life is like after her life? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, what did she gain? What did she learn? And I think, like, you know, from that, like, you get a lot of the sadness of, like, in the sideways, she loves her son. She encourages her son. She knows, like, okay, it didn't work. You died, and it was always going to be that way, and I chose to continue to uphold that cycle. Well, here we are now in this afterworld, and I'm not going to let you go. I'm going to hold on to you with all the love that I've got that I denied you and denied myself. I shall give you now. But it would have been interesting to me maybe to check back in with her in the context of the show itself. Like, if we're getting Charles Widmore coming back to the island in the final season, I think it would have been cool to get Eloise Hawking back on the island as well.
I agree, especially because she's such a mysterious character. I mean, let me float out what I think, and I'm happy to be disproven by season six in The Flash Sideways, because I think it's really dark. Josh, I think there is a non-zero possibility that after all of this, Eloise Hawking commits suicide. I think there's this idea of this is a scene where, like, she realizes just how big the scheme of things are. She's realizing the collateral damage that has amassed. You know, like she says, I do think she is sincere in apologizing to Penny for what happened to Desmond. And I think a lot of it is, you know, coming into picture for her. Her job is done. She got Ajira back on the island so that they could go back in time. Like, her purpose has been fulfilled. And I wonder if seeing what happened to Desmond, combined with just sort of the mounting reminders of what happened to her son and what she sent him off to do, drives her down a really dark path, especially when she feels like that destiny has been fulfilled. And maybe to that point, the height of despair she experiences at the end of her life segues perfectly into The Flash Sideways, where that does happen, where she's able to, like, embrace her son. Yes, it doesn't work, but now there's an environment where, like she said, she doesn't know what's going to happen next. And that's another thing as well, is maybe it's this idea of, well, I don't know what's going to happen next. There is relief there, but there's also fear there. I don't know. It's something that I have been chewing on for a bit. I could see a situation where if she feels like her role has been filled, and sort of looking back on everything she has had to do in response of that role, it overwhelms her to the part where she feels like she does not need to be in this world anymore.
I think regardless of what happens next, you can definitely sense that, like, it's not happy, you know? Yeah. I think, like, the way that, like, you know, there is, like, a real, like, there's, like, big Ben Linus energy to her in the sideways of, like, you know, like, I'm going to stay here a while. Like, I can't come in type of stuff to Ben, like, I think is very evident with Eloise. And I think that that is, like, it's the mark of a character here who, has not resolved everything, who has left a lot of regret behind. And not that everyone who moves on in the end doesn't, you know, end their like natural lives in that same way. Like, I think, I don't think Saeed is like fulfilled, you know, I don't think that Jin and Sun are fulfilled. I don't think John Locke is fulfilled at the end of it. But I think that there is there's a lot that's instructive about who these people were and now are once they wake up and they kind of have the picture of what their life was like, that some of them are like, that was enough. If not, yep, like, that was beautiful. Some of them are like, that was enough, and now I can rest. For Eloise, whatever came at, like, she didn't, like, you know, start dating, probably, you know, like, she didn't start going to movies more often. She, like, has this vibe about her when we meet her in the final season in this context that's, like, not full, not whole. So whatever comes next, I mean, there's like a dark part of me that thinks that like this final conversation that, and just to talk this part through, when she and Widmore have that moment, it's a great scene. I really love seeing her and Allendale together. And when she like slaps him, when it's revealed that, you know, he was my son too. And like the things that they've both felt, yeah, they've sacrificed.
The fact that Widmore claims like, oh, I have to sacrifice my relationship with Penny, and Eloise is like, I raised a boy, your boy, who I sent off to his death. Don't tell me that. And of course, Widmore's going to be an ass about it, right? Like, the fact that he reveals that, you know, he's my son too, I'm sure that Eloise feels in that moment, no, he's not.
Right.
You have not done anything in this boy's life. To quote, you know, an MC, much bereaved MCU character, like, he may be your father, but he wasn't your daddy.
Right. Yeah. Part of me wonders, like, does Widmore have Eloise killed here or something like that? You know, like I think that there's a lot, like, you can let your mind wander about what happens next to these characters.
Do you think he's like, sir, now that, you know, everything's cool here, you know,
do you want to,
exactly. Yeah, maybe there's a non-zero chance that happens. So we skipped over something here. Desmond's okay. Desmond's alive.
He's alive. I thought I lost you. I promised Penny I would never leave you again.
Yeah, Henry Ian Cusick does a great job. He does like a small head shake when she says, you know, I thought I'd lost you. And he like briefly shakes his head, and just his simplicity of, I promised you, Penny. Super sweet. Again, I'm, you know, the Desmond storyline is a little too minimalistic for me, but I'm glad he's alive. And it's also a really great twin destiny thing where the beginning of The Variable, Desmond looks to be on his way to meet death. Faraday is alive and well.
Yeah.
Now it's the opposite. I love how those perspectives change. That we like, get everything
Faraday
on
like
his head.
Comes roaring back onto the island, right? It like filled with so much energy, filled with so much story, and he comes back. And for Desmond, it feels like this dude, the constant, is on his way out. And now he's back, and he's filled with so much promise. And now, as we're about to get into with sound number 8, it is the opposite. For Daniel Faraday, let's listen into the end of the episode.
This is a mistake. He's talking about erasing everything that's ever happened to us, Jack. It's insane.
We disappeared off a plane in midair and ended up in 1977. Getting kind of used to insane.
Wish me luck.
Wait, hey, let him go. Let him go.
Back up. Step away. It's okay. Nobody move. I only want to speak to Eloise. Where is Eloise? Come on, where is she?
I'm sorry, but she's not here right now. Do we know each other?
It doesn't matter. I need you to take me to Eloise.
I already told you she's not here. Let's just take it.
Where's the bomb, Richard? The hydrogen bomb that I told you people to bury, where is it?
Listen to me. Lower your gun, and we'll talk, okay? Nobody has to get hurt here. Just put the gun down.
I'm going to give you 3 seconds.
One.
Don't do this.
Two. Why did you do that?
He had a gun on you.
He wasn't going to shoot me, Eloise.
You knew. You always knew. You knew this was gonna happen. And you sent me here anyway.
Who are you?
I'm your son.
He gone.
It's the most tragic ending in Lost history.
It's brutal. It's so, so brutal. It's just like bone chilling. It is like that, like, cold feeling in your stomach that comes with just
that,
like...
That he has as well, because there's blood pooling in it. Before we get to the Faraday stuff, though, I want to touch briefly on where that sound starts. Because I think it's actually a really great indicator of the shape of things to come. Obviously, like, Jack and Kate literally take a backseat to Daniel Faraday through the latter part of this episode. But we're going to start to get some stuff here, right? Where Kate turns to Jack and is like, this is ridiculous. They're going to, you know, undo everything that we've done here, which I think is going to lead to their sort of, like, schism of how they feel about things. You know, we're going to get to that in the incident, right, of, like, would you be better if we hadn't met each other, right? If we just landed at LAX. And Jack responds by saying, I'm getting kind of used to insane. And it's a good reminder of Jack's transition that really started with 316, or at least was pushed on by 316, and how Jack, Mr. Man of Science, is now saying, I'm getting kind of used to insane. We're a far cry here.
Yeah. I really like that. I like where Jack is at this point. I think that the dynamic between Jack and Kate in this scene on their way up is pretty good. And we're going to get like a really big follow through on that, very early on in Follow the Leader. Can't remember if it's first scene or not. But mm-hmm. we will get like their whole other side to this conversation basically, before Faraday, goes and gets killed.
And walks into the hostile camp firing a gun. I think it's clear, never give Daniel Faraday a gun ever. Either he'll wave it around when he's trying to be peaceful, or he'll make his entrance by just firing into a camp of individuals.
Yay. It's so grim. It's just like, it's horrible to watch every single time. He doesn't even do the full count. He gets shot before the three, and he's not going to shoot anybody.
And I feel love like, that. That's such a great callback to the metronome, though, right? That, like, he spent his life counting. He couldn't finish the count. He can't finish the mission that he's going to carry out.
Yeah. Oh God!
And just the heartbreak that Jeremy Davies does a really great job in this last scene.
So well, he really, really does.
Specifically, the "you knew, you always knew" is just like your heart shatters.
And she says, "Who are you?" And he says, "I'm your son." And then he looks at the camera and goes, "Daniel Faraday."
And those are his last words.
He looks right at the camera and he dies.
Looking down the barrel of the camera. He died how he lived, looking directly into the camera.
It's for sure tragic. I think this is darker than Exposé. I really, really do.
Here's my question.
Because Exposé is funny. Like, that's funny. Like, it's you know.
It can still be dark. I don't want to relitigate this. I don't want to do another full circle thing and go back to Exposé.
We are in the moment. You know, this is the ending. You know?
Yeah, but what I will say, what I will propose is, and maybe this is a podcast we do after the whole shebang is done, I wonder where, is this a Mount Rushmore ending of a Lost episode?
So there can only be four. That's the problem. I don't know.
Is this on the four toes of the endings? Because, like, there's so many good ones.
No, I don't think it is. I don't know. That's so tough to do. When Mount Rushmore only having four heads is so unfair.
Well, blame North Dakota. Unfair.
I know. Oh man. So I don't know. But it is intense. It is awful. It is deeply, deeply, deeply upsetting. And it should be all of these things.
Yeah.
And it also just like adds this huge element of like fragility, this idea that we are on the thinnest of ice moving forward, and like it is a very valuable reminder that like just because a character was in the 2000s doesn't mean they cannot die in the 1970s, and like they deliver on that too by what happens to Juliet, like that an important mm-hmm. character will still die today, you know. So yeah, it's so rough, Mike. It's so
not
rough.
Only that, but it sets up this idea where Faraday was trying to essentially provide this idea of a happy ending for everyone, right? Of, I can make it so that you never come to this island in the first place and you don't have all this suffering and you move on with your lives. And Daniel Faraday himself, his death shows that in this case, with very few exceptions, there are no happy endings in this realm, right? Again, the entire The End is going to be about how everyone finds their happy ending, happily ever after, off the island. But this is a terrible ending for the guy who just said, I can make sure that we have that happy, this resolution. For him to learn in his final moments of existence that this was his entire purpose. That he was pushed and pushed and pushed where it was never enough to do all this work, to have people die closest to him, to go through all this heartbreak and all this mental fatigue, only to get shot and killed by his own mother, is just incredibly morose. Your mileage may vary on ending. I think this might be one of the best deaths in all of Lost because of not only the shock factor, but what it represents in the moment. This idea of, here's this character, Samuel L. Jackson, standing at the edge of the tide pool saying, we're going to kill the sharks. We all just got to stick together. Shark comes out and eats him. Daniel Faraday walks around saying, we can do this. We can change destiny. We might have to be a little careful, but I'm ready to you know, come in with renewed life. And his life immediately ends. It is an incredible ending for the character. We talked about how full circle it is. We talked about how a man that was all about time travel and sort of figuring out the variables and the constants, of course, would die in a way that he would not expect. If the variables are people, he got killed by maybe the biggest variable of them all in the form of his own mother, someone he didn't even expect. He was walking in thinking she was a constant, that he'd have a conversation with her, and instead she becomes a variable. It's just, it's an incredible ending, in my opinion, and just such a fantastically brutal way for this particular character to die.
Yeah, co-signed on all of that. Just absolutely, absolutely amazing. Really, really, really love how it goes down. It's a 4.2 episode very easily.
Same. I think that it's just got a lot going on. There isn't an extraneous scene. I think even the stuff in 2007, again, I talked about how much I love how they set up Desmond versus Faraday in so many ways as the bookend of this episode. And it's also a way to sort of, again, when you see that Eloise Widmore scene, she gets interrupted before, you know, she talks about what I went through. But when you know the circumstances, it's that much of a heavier scene. So I think there's just so much great stuff going on. I think there's a lot of emotionality in Jeremy Davies' performance specifically. I think he really carries this episode on his back. It's a perfect episode of Lost, in my opinion. Yeah. And maybe it might be my only 4.2 of the season.
Wow. Even with the incident coming up. Interesting.
We'll talk about it. I have a quibble with the incident that we'll get into in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Part of me thinks this is defiance to counterbalance my love for season 5.
It's just me being like, no, I got to harsh your groove, man.
Yes, a part of me feels like that's what's going on.
As we say, as I give the variable a 4.2. Because are the hatchlings, so we got an average of 3.8. I think they're a little more all over the board than you may think for an episode that Josh and I absolutely adore. At this moment, we have like, I don't think anyone has given it a 4.2 so far. I've seen as low as a 3.4, and I've seen as high as a 4.1.
That's wild to me. Interesting. It may be a function of we're recording this in the batch, so people are just like waiting to do it in their
right.
in their
so
watch
some
through.
People like, have, yeah, some people like to watch the episode right before the podcast comes out, so they haven't watched the variable, maybe.
For sure. For sure. We have like a bunch of scores that are still not in right now. So I think that that is entirely possible. I think that the variable will score some 4.2s, but it is... With that 3.8 from the audience, it's a 4.07 overall. So it's just shy of LaFleur is still at the top of the season rankings right now.
Yeah, but again,
of
only
the episode ranks for the
three,
season, rather.
Three 100ths separate them. We'll see what happens as time passes, as time finishes for Faraday. But man, just like an absolute powerhouse of an episode to, I think, knock home and drive these characters forward for the last two.
All right. So that's the 4.2 stars. We will reserve feedback for a future episode of the podcast. Let's do the MVP, LVPs. Mike, I've got three MVPs. You've got two. You've got three LVPs. I've got two. Let's just pour one out. Daniel Faraday, come on down. Let's give this poor guy an MVP point. It's such a rough way to go.
I'll give him one as well. I think it's partially due to Jeremy Davies' performance. And also, again, he is, you could say, okay, does it get an LVP point because ultimately he's wrong? But if he doesn't do what he does, like the incident, this doesn't push them to make the incident happen.
Right.
Right. So again, it's sort of meaningless whether he does, whether he's wrong or not. And the fact that you could say maybe he deserves an MVP point for help pushing people to cause the incident, in a manner of speaking, albeit accidentally. So I think that Faraday is worthy of a couple of MVP points here in his final episode.
Yeah, for sure. I am going to give one to Desmond for living, for being alive.
Good idea. The bare minimum here for Desmond. That's going to put him at... So he was in, what, 4 episodes of season 5, and he ends up with 3 points overall. So he basically got, like, MVP points in every episode he was in this season.
Yeah, good for Desmond. You know, Desmond's the best. He got shot. He made it. I'm happy. Saul the Drillman! We don't have a... We'll have no other chances to give Saul the Drillman an MVP point. I'm giving it to him. I want him honored here forever. Just in case we ever do anything with any of this stuff, I don't want to forget Saul the Drillman. This is my chance to give him an MVP.
Well, here's the thing. I'm sure once we end the series, we're going to go through the entire MVP, LVP list. And to that point, I want him etched on that memorial, right? Like, I want a memory incarnate of this character that we came up with at the very beginning of season 5 all those weeks ago. And I think if he doesn't exist on this chart, do we remember him? And so I think he's got to write his entry in the journal here. So I'm all for it. I'm going to give my final MVP point. I don't know if this is controversial or not, because she's certainly going to earn LVP points, including from me. I'm going to do what I did with Ben in Dead is Dead. I'm going to give a point to Eloise Hawking, just because when you watch under the circumstances of what she had to do, the fact that she actually went through with it, I think does deserve kudos. Granted, you know, you might question her methods. Did she really have to push Daniel away so much? I think that was for her own benefit a bit again, so it wasn't as terrible for her. And even then, it still was pretty terrible. And ultimately, she does succeed. She keeps Daniel on the path and is able to convince him to go to the island and kickstart everything into motion. So I think this is a big episode for Fionnuala Flanagan and the middle stage Eloise that we're going to see in this episode. So I think, even though she's going to earn a couple of LVPs here, I think she deserves at least one MVP for actually succeeding in her mission, as sad as it may be.
I think that that's totally fair. I think that that's really well reasoned. I'm going to give her an LVP point for killing her son.
And I'm going to give her an LVP point for that as well. I know that that's going to leave her with a negative one, but she also shoots and kills her son. I feel like that is a major, major event that she is going to have massive regrets for as soon as next episode.
Yeah, I think that those LVP points are deserved. I think that the Eloise that we get next week is a really great character to talk about, though. So I'm excited about it. While giving an LVP to Eloise for shooting her son with my second LVP point, I don't think that he should go without blame here as Charles Widmore, who who also is pushing his son to go to the island, and not just because he needs him for his expedition, probably, but also because of what comes next. And he is doing his role in maintaining the time loop and getting Faraday back to the island and everything. So if we're going to blame Eloise for like the role in encouraging these events to happen, I feel like we gotta throw some blame at Charles Widmore as well.
Especially because Charles Widmore comes in and is just like I said before, sort of has the audacity to be like, well, he's my son too, even though he has, outside of that research grant, it seems like he's done nothing in Faraday's life, whether it was Eloise or Widmore's choice. Like, he has actively not been a part of Daniel Faraday's life. So he comes in with a toad in his couple of scenes here. So I think, listen, you're never going to argue with me to give Charles Widmore an LVP point. And to that point, Josh, I'm going to use this as an excuse to give an LVP point to one of your favorites. Radzinski is getting one here.
Good.
He lets them escape. He lets them get away.
Yeah. And also, he sucks. And if he's in an episode, I want him to be eligible for LVP points.
Yeah. And so I do believe, actually, with that, both Widmore and Radzinski have now passed Ben. They're tied at -7 points apiece at the bottom of the LVP charts. Let's go from the bottom to the top here. I don't know if this is controversial. I think I'm going to give an LVP point to Sawyer. Because I think now we realize that the whole knock... Like, we talked about this last week, right? Like, was it smart for him to immediately knock out Phil? And I think things are falling apart for him. And it's almost like, in retrospect, the things that he is doing and the fact that everything is unraveling is not a great look for the character this week. Again, for someone who has had an incredible season so far, this is the moment where he's caught flat-footed, and I think that deserves some acknowledgement.
Yeah, I think that that's fair, and also he's just been riding high, so I'm not gonna like get mad at you dinging him here this close to the end of the line. Let's see how he does with these next couple of episodes, because right now Sawyer is out there in the lead, but the late great John Locke has 8 MVP points to Sawyer's 9 right now. How is that gonna hold?
So if Sawyer falls 1 point, he and Locke are going to be probably... Well, actually, no. I don't know if they'll be co-MVPs, because, again, we have Smokey right behind with 6. There's a good chance if he gets a couple points in these next 2 episodes, we might see Smokey, like Bobby Fink this, come from behind and end up being the top finisher for Season 5.
I think it's possible. It is a really competitive space right now, and I think that's exciting. I love that coming here into the end of the season. And we're close. Coming next, follow the leader, the penultimate episode of Season 5. I want to give a little bit of a warning. There is an outside shot that this podcast is going to be delayed and will be one of the first, maybe the first time we would miss a Friday release. Mm-hmm. If it comes to that, I hope it doesn't. I think we're going to be okay. But just so you all know, it is a possibility that we are going to be a little late on Follow the Leader. We are aiming to not have that be the case. But if you wake up next Friday, if you listen to these the days they come out, and you don't have a Down the Hatch in your feed, it's scheduling stuff on my end, trying to make this work. I think we're going to be fine. But just so you're not like, where is it?
Yeah, so you're not Daniel Faraday, like, oh my God, it was you. Yeah. It's not here all along.
Yes, I think we're going to be okay here. In case we are not, just the heads up. But get your feedback in. Down the hatch at postshowrecaps.com. We would love to get that feedback from you for Follow the Leader. You definitely can get it in on time for that recording. So please send it in our way. Follow the Leader, which I think is probably viewed as like another, as you love to say, a nothing burger, but we've been through this before, Mike. These like final, you know, like pre-finale episodes. Yep. That are really like deck setters, you know?
Yeah, but the penultimate episodes of Lost are weird. There's a whole, you know, between we started off on a kind of a low note with Born to Run. 3 minutes is a weird one. You know, Greatest Hits is incredible. But you could say more so is like part one of a 3-part finale. Cabin Fever, I know you had your issues with, but I think is a strong episode. So we've been on a pretty good beat. Follow the Leader, I think it's safe to say it's moving the chains. I think after this big blow up that happened in The Variable, we're going to get some plot moving forward as Jack moves forward with now his new purpose. Sawyer and Juliet figure out what happens now that the jig is up. And meanwhile, in 2007, you know, Locke's going to present his own mission to Ben. Let's go and kill Jacob. So it's an important setup for what's to come in the incident. But I'm intrigued to see, just looking at it as an episode, how much water is it going to hold?
Yeah, I'm excited to really get into it. We're in that final stretch here of season 5. It's exciting times here on Down the Hatch. Happy birthday to us. My
this
God.
Is amazing.
Do you think Eric Divestein remembered to wish Down the Hatch a happy birthday?
I mean, at this point, we're recording early and early, even the time this is being released. So I certainly hope so. I hope he covered his bases. But yeah. I mean, let me just say again, 2 years going strong. It is wild. Just think, that's 2/3 of the amount of time Desmond spent on the island.
Yeah.
Like, that's just, think about that. We have been here at our microphones pushing random buttons as well. And I cannot express how much of an immense pleasure it has been. And this has certainly been, I think, the most raw and upfront I have been about myself and the love I have for this show that has unlocked so much of my love for pop culture in general. And it's a scary place to be. You leave yourself open like Daniel Faraday walking into the hostiles camp. But due to the hatchlings who, for some reason, tolerate you and I, Gavin, for hours on end every week and support it, become patrons, give us Barrick's Darmdarian fan art, send us in Lindelofs. It is truly, truly amazing. And it wouldn't happen without you here, Josh. You were the Daniel Faraday of this. You were the one driving forward.
Am I getting shocked, maybe?
Yeah, you are shocked. You're shocked by the amount of love you're getting right now.
I'm hopefully not getting shot, but I am shocked that we're still doing this. To some degree, I really am. But like, totally delighted simultaneously that people have come along for the ride and have, you know, been a part of this journey, moving this thing forward. It's just been an utter pleasure to do. I'm really, really excited as we are here in the home stretch, even as like we are starting to get into like, does Lost lose its way type of territory. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm really excited for those conversations. I'm excited to spend some time with these characters in their like final moments, both in life for some of them and then on the show, for all of them. It's an utter pleasure each and every week. It's my favorite thing. It's my favorite show, and getting to like have like 2 hour plus conversations about it every single week with you, Mike, has just been such a joy. So thanks to everybody who's made that possible. It's just been amazing. Absolutely
completely
incredible.
Agree. I do not know how I could appreciate Lost in so many different contexts, but getting to talk it over, getting to look at it again through a very different lens than who I was even the last time I watched the show, especially hearing from you all, reading you all, everybody reading these stories about, you know, this episode aired when, you know, this life moment happened to me, hearing about your Lost fandom stories, your random stories about Lost through the years. It is wild to me that this show is, you know, going on a decade since it's ended, but it is such a fervent fan base that really shows how much of a special show it was, that we have all these memories connected with it. It is such a part of our pop culture repertoire in so many ways that we can forgive those that said, oh, I guess they were dead the whole time. We can shake our heads courteously and say, no, 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 it's much more special than that. And thank you to everyone who's reached out to us. I know that people have said this podcast has served as a real buoy to them, I think, in, as I mentioned before, a really tempestuous couple of years for the world. And I got to say, it's reciprocal. I think doing this podcast, being able to track, I think, our own lives through the podcast as well, is incredibly interesting. And in all the variables that have existed throughout our 2 years on Down the Hatch, this is an amazing constant to have.
100% agreed. Could not agree even a little bit harder if I tried, because it is so hard the way that I agree. It is incredible. We
you can't
are going
even
to
drill through it. That's how
no,
hard it is.
It's impossible. I can't even get through. I've been trying. I've been using my diamond tip drill and it's not even working. It's unbelievable. I love you guys. You guys are doing great work here. You talk about
Saul.
Me every week. It's so good.
You're not just buttering us up because we gave you an MVP point,
no,
are you?
No, I'm very, very grateful. I never would have expected it. I kind of figured I'd just like go the way of my cousin, DJ Dom, who you guys don't talk about quite as much
anymore.
We just
made a reference to him in this episode.
I know, and I'm going to call him after this, and I'll tell him, and he's going to be
like,
cousin,
oh,
they remember?
Saul the Drillman?
Yeah, DJ Dom and me, Saul, we're just, you know, we're just cousins out here. We hope that you guys remember us when it's all done.
We will, and hopefully you all remember us. Because again, we still have a little bit more to go, but you know, when we're tracking like lost landmarks in terms of our watch through, this is definitely one of them. I know it's outside of the Lost show proper, but this is the 100th episode, and it's a, sort of a reminder to us, we've got less than 4 months on this puppy to go, or a little bit over 4 months. You know, we are truly reaching the final stretch of episodes.
It's crazy. It's wild. I can't wait for it. We'll be back with our next podcast. It's going to be Follow the Leader. Follow along with everything we are doing to make sure you don't miss any of it. I'm on Twitter at Ron Howard. Mike is at a Mike Bloom type. There's so much more that we are doing in the podcast universe. We'll tweet about it. You'll see it. Make sure you check out everything that's happening on Post Show Recaps. If you're a patron of Post Show Recaps, we're so grateful for that. You get down the hatch a couple days early. We hope that you enjoy that early access. We'll be back next week with more Follow the Leader. Until then, everybody, take care. Bye-bye. 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 22, 42, 4, 8,